Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Particularly Mr. Haitian Jack and his activities in terms of set, and you said it seems Mr. Shakur became aware of Haitian Jack's role and what he was doing. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of similar parallels with Mr. Suge Knight, who you talk quite a bit about in your book. Another individual that seems to have a lot of evidence that would support this person might have been an informant and working to cause further disruptions for Mr. Shakur. You actually show a lot of evidence in terms of CIA connections to Death Row Records, Michael Harris and his connections, Dave Kenner, and how the company got their seed money in the first place.
You got a good memory, Jeff.
I read the book.
I know, you got a good memory for it. I appreciate these questions.
And also, which I had not even thought about, you pointed out in your book, when NWA first came out, they did the video for Express Yourself. Dr. Dre has a verse in that song where he talks about, I don't smoke weed or cess. It's known for messing up your brain. And this was on MTV. They used to play this all the time. Very public.
Yeah.
No weed. He moves to Death Row and becomes infamous for his album, The Chronic. I had never even thought about that and the impact that Suge Knight and Death Row Records had. Just looking at their logo, a black person in the electric chair, the conflict that they just continue to ignite, the whole East Coast, West Coast thing. You pointed out Suge Knight going on stage and taking verbal shots at Sean Combs. I already alluded to the CIA connections, and you point out in your book litany of off-duty police officers who worked security at Death Row Records. Could you kind of help us get a much better understanding of the environment that Tupac was in at Death Row Records?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll say that it was the book Labyrinth by a Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair writer shows that Dave Kenner, a white lawyer, was actually the real head of Death Row Records. He wrote the documents, legal documents, that made himself CEO of the umbrella group over Death Row Records. So he was the highest man on the totem pole regarding that, and I believe he, you know, so Suge Knight was a little lower in the totem pole in that regard, and, you know, in their work with, as I believe, which was collaborators with U.S. intelligence in the assassination of Tupac Shakur. But basically when Tupac then got into that 1.5 to 4.5 years in maximum security prison, I document how I believe they used penal coercion tactics, which they use on activists in jail, to mess up their minds. Amnesty International did report on penal coercion tactics, and I found evidence that all the penal coercion tactics were used on him, they were in that report, plus extra tactics like sticking their gloved fingers up his rectum, saying they were looking for contraband every time a visitor came to see Tupac, even though that the whole visit was within guards' eyesight. So they basically tortured him in jail and really messed up his mind while he was in jail. Now, he had $1.2 million in bail money of the what was said to be $3 million bail he had to have to get out of jail, you know, while he awaited an appeal of his charge. Usually you only need 10% of the bail money. He gave close to half of the bail money, and they still wouldn't let him go. Only when, and so Death Row Records, you know, Suge Knight and Dave Kenner, Suge Knight being the supposed head of Death Row Records and Dave Kenner the lawyer, his lawyer who founded Death Row Records with actual Michael Harris, who was, as you say, connected to the CIA. He was one of the two associates of Freeway Ricky Ross, who was known to be buying from CIA dealers, CIA-linked dealers. Anyway, traffickers, I mean, you know, crack traffickers. So here we have a lot of evidence about Death Row, even its founding. Then we have Suge Knight and Dave Ken are visiting Tupac in jail repeatedly from California to Dannemora, New York. And so then a high-level white police officer happens to find that his dozens and dozens of his fellow police officers were at all levels of death row records, not just security guards, but all levels of death row records. And his higher-ups, his bosses, apparently thinking that he'd just be okay with the plan, revealed to him that you could call these people covert agents, all right, these fellow officers in death row records. So, you know, they assumed that he'd be going along with the plan, that he would, you know, being white, he'd be just as racist as them, but he didn't. He investigated further, and he tried to come out with all this information, which his conclusions of his investigation was that basically that death row set up Tupac's, you know, murder and then murdered Biggie Smalls, who he was assigned as the lead investigator of, Biggie Smalls, when he was murdered. But they also murdered Biggie Smalls in order to make it look like an East Coast, West Coast rap war that caused their deaths versus his fellow police officers just murdering these rap stars. And he really didn't know why, but he just, that's what he found. And so I argue that, as you said, I'm really glad you brought this point up, that I believe that Death Row Records was a U.S. intelligence front company. And they lured Dr. Dre from NWA after they were investigating WA, because the NWA did some political music like F the Police and, you know, just saying don't smoke weed, it'll give you brain damage and stuff like that. And they were one of those popular rap bands. They broke up NWA. They had tried to get their concerts canceled. The FBI tried to get their concerts canceled. And they did get a number of their concerts canceled. But then they, or at least a few of them, but anyway, they broke up NWA. Dre went to Death Row. Dre ended up leaving Death Row with nothing, even though he was the creative force behind Death Row, I think, at first. And then they lured Tupac, went to Death Row, even though Tupac said he told his business manager, Watani Tayahimba, he cried on his shoulder saying, "I know I'm selling my soul to the devil," because Watani Tayahimba then had to cut his ties to Tupac because he knew he'd endanger his whole organization, the New African People's Organization, if he had any link to Death Row Records. He didn't know what was going on inside Death Row Records, he said, but he knew there was something really sinister in Death Row Records. Once Tupac's at Death Row Records, they continue some of the same penal coercion tactics that were used on him in prison in terms of beating people right in front of him and scaring him, doing these other things. They constantly fed him weed and alcohol to keep his mind messed up. They produced the most negative lyrics he had ever, you know, written or produced. They completely promoted the East Coast, West Coast rap war. They were found to be laundering money and selling drugs, trafficking drugs. And, you know, this is what came out, you know, in the book Labyrinth and the film Biggie and Tupac, done by award-winning documentary filmmaker Nick Broomfield. So in that, you know, the final night, Tupac's in Las Vegas, he didn't, and his, actually one of his two personal bodyguards tried to get him not to go to Las Vegas. His name was Kevin Hackey, and he ended up revealing that he was an FBI undercover agent at that time. And he tried to get Tupac not to go to Vegas, but to go to Atlanta instead, because he actually turned on the FBI. As soon as Death Row heard he told Tupac not to go to Vegas, they fired Kevin Hackey. And then Kevin Hackey said that the FBI imprisoned him for several months on a frame-up because he turned on them. And Kevin Hackey said on, you know, told Nick Broomfield, that was repeated in the film Biggie and Tupac, that he has documents to prove that the FBI were in the motorcade when Tupac was assassinated. So they watched him be assassinated, and they obviously watched because they had orchestrated and they wanted to make sure the job was done, or they actually participated in it. But in them and the ATF were both in that motorcade. And the FBI and ATF were also on the scene of Biggie Smalls' murder, and there's pictures to prove that pictures were taken within minutes of Biggie Smalls' murder. And, you know, the FBI had those pictures. Police intelligence had those pictures, and they came out in the film Biggie and Tupac also. It came out in the Los Angeles Times, believe it or not. And it was found that one of those FBI agents was also, because they overlap, a police intelligence detective from New York City out in Los Angeles where he was murdered, and was part of what was a rap special rap intelligence unit to target rappers. And that also came out in further media articles in, about the year 2002-03, that they had lists of rappers they were targeting. And New York was, Miami Herald said that New York was training police units nationwide to target rappers and using kill and tell tactics, according to the Source magazine.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to point out for our listeners, he goes into a lot of detail around what happened in Vegas, both with Suge Knight manipulating Tupac. He was not going to originally ride with Suge
right.
Knight. Suge Knight spoke with him and got him to switch and ride in his vehicle.
Suge
Knight,
he was gonna ride.
Yeah. He did not drive to the closest hospital. He drove the opposite direction, ended up flattening all four of his tires. Just a lot of strange things.
13 bullets came at Tupac, and, Tupac's half the size of Suge Knight, and virtually none, they say none of the bullets actually hit Suge Knight head on. He was only hit by debris, but either way, 13 bullets coming his way, they purposely avoid killing Suge Knight. That's pretty amazing. But it also shows
precision.
That he was, it's pretty precise. It's incredibly professional hit.
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly, and a lot of the same earmarks, witnesses ignored, who had information. Just guess I would say a horrible investigation if you're really trying to get to the truth of what happened. But if that's not your interest, then I guess they did the correct thing.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, June 24, 2021. So I have been told sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Yikes. So that was John Patash. He's been referenced at least going back to the Geronimo Pratt biography that we just finished up, mentioned repeatedly. Keeps saying, man, I need to give him a call to ask him about this year book Labyrinth, because, man, I don't know. And City of Lies, man, I posted it on social media earlier this week. I was out frolicking a little while. It was a repugnant week of white supremacy racism here in Seattle. But I passed a red box for people who don't know. That's I guess they have them out in front of like grocery stores, supermarkets, where it's a machine and it's got like different movies that are out, more recent movies that are out. I think it's DVD. I have no idea. I haven't done Redbox in a while, but I think it's DVD. But you can just pick the movie right there for a dollar or whatever it is and just bring it back, I believe. And so I looked, and it just so happened that the marquee movie they were promoting, the biggest picture, City of Lies, the film adaptation of this book, which I keep saying, Forrest Whitaker portraying the author Randall Sullivan in the movie, which I just, what in the world, at minimum perplexing. And City of Lies, which was released in 2018, I thought that was kind of odd too, to have a movie that is 3 years old getting double billing. In fact, it had the big large graphic at the top of the red box machine, and then they had another insert in the drama section. So I was like, wow, they want to make sure that people hear about how Tupac and Biggie were killed by other black people and Suge Knight. Anyway, this is the book club. Randall Sullivan, Labyrinth. This is our third study session as we chug along through the book. Last week we heard Russell Poole suggest that, hey, this Suge Knight fella is going around threatening to anally rape people, smacking around black people and beating up Vanilla Ice, and is not being punished for it because the LAPD is scared of being called racist. Yes. So that's what we heard last week, in addition to lots of different unsupported rumors about death row beatings and shenanigans. That's why I kept saying, man, John Patash, to give additional insight. David Kenner, the white man who founded death row in the first place, and possible links to the CIA in this organization, and having lots of off-duty officers, not just black officers, working for this organization. I just thought that was a lot of important detail from Mr. Patash. His first visit to the cows way, way, way back 2009, our first year of existence, where Mr. Patash talked in detail about his first book, The FBI's War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. Don't think I missed or minimized the content about the terror, torture tactics used against Tupac Shakur and other victims of white supremacy, all of these anal cavity searches. I believe we heard something about that in Geronimo Pratt's biography, train wreck, and different attempts with cavities. Oh, you got to go visit somebody. We got to cavity search you. We might have to cavity search your mom or your sister if they come in, because we know you niggers are sneaking in contraband and all the rest. Just keep hearing the same patterns over and over and over. Rethinking Rufus, the man knot, Black Misandry through and through, the delectable Negro. Talk about how being in greater confinement, how they can really do lots of psychological experiments. I think we talked about that before with Huey P. Newton. Anywho, we will go ahead and get started. Lots more details about the shootings of Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G. this week. Context of White Supremacy, Labyrinth by Randall Sullivan, Suspected White Supremacist, audio segment one.
During her 1971 pregnancy, Afeni Shakur was standing trial as a member of the Panther 21, a group accused of conspiring to blow up several New York department stores. She named her son Tupac, Afeni Shakur liked to tell people, for the last Inca chief to be murdered by the Spanish conquistadors. Tupac's mother had been born Alice Faye Williams. She was a farm girl from North Carolina who took her new name after moving to Brooklyn and starting an affair with one of Malcolm X's bodyguards. "Chants of black power were like a lullaby when I was a kid," Tupac himself once said. Her acquittal in the Panther 21 trial gave Afeni Shakur a short-lived celebrity in the early 70s. While living in a subsidized apartment in Manhattan near Columbia University, she lectured at Harvard and Yale. Her only son was called the Black Prince and forecast as the future leader of the revolution. By the late 70s, though, as the epoch of radical chic passed, Afeni and her son were reduced to living on welfare in the South Bronx, while many adult members of Tupac's Black Panther family were either behind bars or on the run. Tupac's godfather, Elmer Geronimo Pratt, was convicted in 1968 of murdering a schoolteacher during a robbery in Santa Monica and sentenced to life in prison. The boy's aunt, Asata Shakur, Joanne Chesimard, was found guilty in 1977 of murdering a New Jersey state trooper, though she did manage to break out of prison 2 years later and flee to Cuba. Tupac's stepfather, Mutulu Shakur, was found guilty of conspiring in that prison escape, as well as in the attempted robbery of a Brinks armored car in which two police officers and a guard were killed. Tupac was never certain about his father's identity. Afeni had been married to Black Panther activist Lumumba Shakur when she became pregnant, but told her son that his father was either a Harlem drug dealer who answered to Legs or another Panther Party member, Billy Garland. Garland claimed paternity, but Tupac reaped little benefit from this. He rarely saw the man, who never amounted to much anyway. Garland was a far better choice than Legs, however, who re-entered Tupac's life when the boy was about 12 and stayed around just long enough to turn Afeni into a crack addict. Afeni and her two children, Tupac had a younger sister named Sakua, moved to Baltimore in 1984 when Legs was arrested for credit card fraud. The man died of a drug-induced heart attack a short time later. Legs' death fucked Tupac up, Afeni once told an interviewer. It was 3 months before he cried. After he did, he told me, "I miss my daddy." "I remember crying all the time," Tupac told an interviewer about his early childhood. "My major thing growing up was that I just couldn't fit in." Baltimore would be good to the boy, though. His mother enrolled him in the city's School for the Arts, where he studied ballet, poetry, jazz, and acting. He performed in Shakespearean plays and played the Mouse King in The Nutcracker. The teenager who had been teased about his slight build and effeminate features in New York would say that he finally felt in touch with himself during his time at the School for the Arts. I was starting to feel like I really wanted to be an artist, Tupac explained. I was fucking white girls. The idyll ended when Tupac moved to California in 1988 to escape the squalor and poverty of a home where his mother smoked a crack pipe all during her third pregnancy. His new residence was in Marin City, an isolated ghetto in a geographic depression surrounded by rolling hills where white people with money had created a quasi-rustic suburbia. He didn't fit in with the black kids he met in California, Tupac said. I dressed like a hippie. I couldn't play basketball. I was the target for street gangs. They used to jump me. I thought I was weird because I was writing poetry and I hated myself. I used to keep it a secret. I was really a nerd. Tupac's self-esteem was considerably enhanced in 1990, however, when he got a job as a dancer with the rap group Digital Underground. Only 1 year later, executives at Interscope heard a demo tape Tupac had made and signed him to a recording contract of his own. The young rapper's 1991 album, Tupacalypse Now, sold 500,000 copies, thanks in part to Vice President Dan Quayle, who declared that Tupac's tales of young black men in pitched battle with the pigs who invaded their neighborhoods had no place in our society. Tupac had started a film career that same year, landing a part in Juice, even before his first album was recorded. When he moved to Los Angeles in 1992, however, Shakur immediately became absorbed in the gang culture of Crips and Bloods. In part, he was doing what artists and writers always do, sponging up stories, characters, and attitudes he could use in his songs. The young men who controlled the streets of Compton and South Central LA, however, placed an unusually high premium on authenticity. The only options they gave anyone, even visiting rap stars, were hard or soft, gangsta or punk. Either have the heart of a killer or expect to be treated like any other sucker. Fair game for anyone who is bad enough to take the watch off your wrist or the money from your pocket. At 5'8" and 150 pounds, with fine, soft features and eyes that just wouldn't go dead, Tupac scared absolutely nobody. At least, not until he bought his first pistol and began practicing with it at local firing ranges. He started lifting weights, too, and began to cover his torso with tattoos, the most famous being the huge letters that spelled out Thug Life across his solar plexus, with the image of an assault rifle etched into his flesh above it. Tupac's first major brush with the law made headlines that summer, when he went home to attend the celebration of Marin City's 50th anniversary and got into a shouting match with some young men from the neighborhood that did not end until shots were fired and a 6-year-old boy was killed by a bullet to the head. Tupac's half-brother was arrested for murder, only to be released because of insufficient evidence, but all that most people remembered were headlines with the name Shakur in them. Back in L.A., Tupac kept even the gangbangers guessing. When he wore red on the cover of his second album, 1993's Strictly For My Niggas, word spread that he had joined the Bloods. But soon after, he posed for pictures with a blue bandana on his head. During a drive to the Fox lot in Hollywood, where he was to tape a segment for In Living Color, Tupac pulled a gun on a limo driver who had asked him not to smoke pot in the vehicle, then looked on as the members of his entourage beat the man senseless. He played opposite Janet Jackson in his second movie, Poetic Justice, that summer, then on Halloween got into a shootout with two off-duty white police officers in Atlanta, wounding one man in his abdomen and the other in his buttocks. Charges of aggravated assault were dropped only when it came out that the cops Tupac had shot were a pair of drunken yahoos who had started things by brandishing a pistol stolen from a precinct evidence room, and that on the day of Tupac's first court hearing, one of them had been charged with aggravated assault, while both were accused of using the word niggers in a police report. The attendant publicity made Tupac simultaneously a media villain and a ghetto champion. By November of 1993, when he moved to New York for the filming of Above the Rim, Tupac's legal expenses had mounted to the point that he began telling people he had to change his life and clean up his act or declare bankruptcy. Smelling blood in the water, Suge Knight made his first overture to Tupac, paying $200,000 for a single song, Pour Out a Little Liquor. When Knight offered a long-term recording contract, however, Tupac turned Suge down, choosing to align himself instead with music promoter Jacques Agnon, better known as Haitian Jack. The rapper's bad press, meanwhile, continued to mount. He was the target of civil suits that blamed his lyrics for the shooting of a Texas state trooper and the paralysis of a young woman who was hit by a stray bullet during a near riot at one of his concerts in Arkansas. The headlines were louder still when, shortly before Thanksgiving, Tupac was arrested for the sexual assault that would send him to Dannemora. What had happened would never be clear, largely because the victim was a young woman whose own behavior inspired neither trust nor sympathy. Tupac claimed he first encountered Ayanna Jackson when she approached him on the dance floor of the downtown Manhattan nightclub, Nell's, unzipped his pants, and led him by the penis to a dark corner of the club where she performed oral sex on him. Jackson insisted that Tupac had chased her all over the club before a brief and furtive encounter in which he pushed my head down on his penis in a brief 3-second encounter. Whatever, the young woman not only slept with Shakur that night, but showed up 4 days later at Tupac's suite in the Parker Meridian, wearing a tight dress and within minutes was giving him a massage in the bedroom. The two soon were joined by Jacques Agnon and a friend of the promoter's. Tupac and the other two men claimed Jackson was a willing participant in group sex. The young woman said she was the victim of a gang rape. 1 year later, a New York jury would essentially split the difference, but in the meantime, Tupac was attending to other troubles. On February 1, 1994, Tupac was in Los Angeles Municipal Court to answer assault charges filed against him by film director Alan Hughes, who, along with his partner brother Albert, had tried to cast Tupac in the film Menace to Society. When he read the script, however, Tupac decided the Hughes brothers had cast him as a sucker and showed up on the set of a video they were filming with an entourage of gangbangers. Alan Hughes was beaten while his brother fled the scene. After pleading guilty in court, Tupac was to face sentencing on March 10th. Less than 12 hours before his scheduled court appearance, however, Tupac was confronted by 5 Crips at a convenience store on Sunset Boulevard. When one of the 5 smashed him in the face, Tupac grabbed a pair of scissors from a display case and chased the group into the street while dozens of witnesses looked on. The news was in the morning papers, and national TV crews were on hand at the courthouse the next day as the prosecution argued that Mr. Shakur was a young man who could not control his temper. Tupac, sentenced to 15 days in jail, flew back to New York as soon as he finished his time. On the evening of November 28, 1994, shortly after a Manhattan jury began to deliberate charges of sodomy, sexual abuse, and weapons possession against him, Tupac was smoking pot as he made his way to the Quad Recording Studios off Times Square. He had been promised $7,000 badly needed dollars for a guest appearance on a song by an obscure Uptown Records rapper named Little Sean, a deal set up through Tupac's new friend, Biggie Smalls. Biggie's friend Lil Cease shouted, "Yo, Pac, come on up," through an open window as Tupac and 2 companions entered the building. Shakur's occasional road manager, Freddie Nichols, was the first to get a sense that something might be wrong. The security guard sat at a desk in the lobby reading a newspaper. "And I wonder why he don't just let us in," Nichols remembered. There was a man wearing fatigues also in the lobby. When the door finally opened, Tupac and his friends headed toward the elevator, but another guy with fatigues on must have come in right behind us, Nichols recalled. They had guns out, told us to get on the floor. Pac wouldn't, so they shot him in the arm. The elevator opened a moment later. Biggie had sent Lil Cease downstairs with a friend named Nino to show Tupac up to the studio. But when he looked out into the lobby from inside the elevator, the rapper said, "I see Tupac laying on the floor and 2 guys coming with guns from both sides of him. I'm hitting the door close button, but the door won't close. I'm so scared I just froze. Finally, we got back in the elevator. The door closed. Me and Nino looked at each other. Is that really going down?" Nichols was lying on the floor outside the elevator right next to Shakur. Figuring this had to be a robbery, Nichols recalled, "I popped Tupac's chains, said, 'Y'all want the chains? Take the chains.' But they didn't want the jewelry, which is why I knew they weren't there to rob us." By the time the 2 men in fatigues walked out of the lobby, Tupac had been shot 5 times. 1 bullet creased his head, while another shattered a testicle. The men in fatigues had eventually stripped him of a $30,000 diamond ring and $10,000 in gold chains, yet left the diamond-studded Rolex watch Jacques Agnon had given Tupac as a present. Though wounded as well in the thigh and abdomen, Tupac managed to make it into an elevator and ride 8 floors up to the studio where he was scheduled to perform. He used paper towels to staunch the blood from his wounds, Nichols recalled, said he wanted to call my mom and my boys, then asked for a smoke. Andre Harrell, Puffy Combs, and Biggie Smalls were among those in the room. All were dripping with jewelry, and none would look him in the eye, said Tupac, who would become convinced the three men viewed him as a rival they wished to eliminate. A team of 12 doctors at Bellevue Hospital operated on Tupac during the early morning hours of November 29th, then were shocked when he checked himself out that evening. His life was in danger if he stayed, explained Tupac, who chose to spend the night of the 29th at the home of his friend, actress Jasmine Guy. A team of bow-tied Fruit of Islam security guards surrounded Tupac's wheelchair as he arrived in court to hear the jury's verdict. Relief at his acquittal on the more serious sodomy and weapons charges was almost instantly overwhelmed by the knowledge that being found guilty of sexual abuse would mean prison time. He was given 2.5 months to convalesce, first at Metropolitan Hospital, then at Jasmine Guy's apartment, but on Valentine's Day 1995, he received a sentence of 4.5 years in state prison. He began doing his time at Rikers Island, where he read Machiavelli's The Prince until he had memorized it, then announced in an interview with Vibe that he was done with gangsta rap. "That shit is dead," he told the magazine's reporter. "If thug life is real, then let somebody else represent it, because I'm tired of it. I represented it too much." As his single Dear Mama rose on the charts, a rumor spread on the streets that he had been raped in Rikers by members of a Latin gang. Tupac then was transferred to Clinton Correctional in Dannemora, where he was initiated into prison life by a strip search and rectal examination. From the beginning of his career, Tupac had come across as a young man torn between his demons and his angels. The hit single on Tupacalypse Now was Brenda's Got a Baby, a song Tupac said was inspired by the newspaper account of a 12-year-old girl who got pregnant by a cousin, then threw her baby down an incinerator shaft. "No male rappers at all anywhere were talking about problems females were having," he explained when asked why he had written the song. Yet on the same album, Tupac boasted in another song, "This is the life, new bitch every night, never tripped off a wife." He showed up for his first film audition wearing the tattooed words Outlaw on one arm and Heartless on the other, then recited the lyrics of the Robert Frost poem, "Nothing Gold Can Stay." At Dannemora, Tupac became engaged to a recent graduate of John Jay College who planned to go to law school, didn't smoke marijuana, and refused to sleep with him on their first date. "She's my first and only girlfriend ever," he told an interviewer, shortly before marrying the young woman. Vibe printed a prison interview in which Tupac seemed to take full responsibility for what had happened to Ayanna Jackson at the Parker Meridian Hotel. "Even though I'm innocent of the charge, I'm not innocent in terms of the way I was acting. I'm just as guilty for doing nothing as I am for doing things." He was ashamed, Tupac said, about not intervening to defend the young woman from the two men who actually did rape her. At the same time he made these pronouncements, however, Tupac was plotting revenge against those he believed were responsible for the shooting at Quad Studios: Puffy Combs, Andre Harrell, and Biggie Smalls, whose single, One More Chance, had just hit number one on Billboard's chart. "Biggie's involvement was what cut him deepest," said Tupac, who had been convinced by letters he received at Dannemora that the Brooklyn rapper helped set him up. "He thought Big was his friend," Tupac said. "The two of them used to get together to play skee-ball every time he visited New York." When Tupac made his accusations public in an interview with Vibe, Biggie, Puffy, and Andre Harrell replied with a brief letter to the editor in which the three denied they had anything to do with the shooting, then expressed the hope that the feud between the East and West Coasts could be brought to an end. Puffy Combs claimed that he had written personally to Tupac asking for a meeting to clear the air and assured the imprisoned rap star that he and Biggie got nothing but love for you. Next to his prison sentence, Tupac's biggest problems were financial. The attorneys he hired to defend him against lawsuits and criminal charges all across the country had exhausted his bank accounts. During the past several years, he had become the sole supporter of his mother, his sister, her baby, his aunt, her children, as well as assorted cousins and hangers-on. Even as he renounced gangsta rap and made plans to move to Arizona with his new bride and raise children in the sunshine, Suge Knight was beckoning from the shadows, promising not only to solve all his money problems, but to secure his release from prison as well. Tupac's childhood friend, Watani Tiahimba, visited him in prison during the late summer of 1995 and begged the rapper not to sign a contract with Death Row Records. Sobbing, Tiahimba recalled, Tupac hugged him tight and said, "I know I'm selling my soul to the devil." Tupac signed the 3-page handwritten agreement drafted by David Kenner during the early autumn, and on October 12th, the day he was released from Dannemora, he flew back to Los Angeles with Knight and Kenner aboard a private jet. He was in a Death Row recording studio that same night. Overwhelmed with gratitude for his release from prison, Tupac parroted Suge Knight in an interview with Source magazine. "Whether the odds are in your favor or appear to be stacked against you, the Death Row family sticks with you." Tupac Shakur's mother, sister, aunt, and assorted other relatives who depended upon him for support now were part of the Death Row family also. Shortly after he signed Tupac to a recording contract, Suge Knight bought Afeni Shakur a new home. And when she and her relations visited Los Angeles, Suge lodged them in a luxury hotel, the Westwood Marquis, where they ran up huge room service bills. Tupac was spending his days, and most of his nights as well, at Death Row Studios in Tarzana, where producers were amazed by the facility with which he wrote and recorded rap lyrics, despite being high on marijuana and drinking heavily most of the time. What Suge received in exchange for his largesse was the reflected glow of his new rapper's starlight. Tupac was by far the biggest celebrity in the history of the genre, aided considerably by his film appearances. During late 1995 and early 1996, dozens of stories appeared in the hip-hop press suggesting that only the fearsome Suge Knight, with his gangbanger thugs and audacious street tactics, could protect Shakur from those who wanted him dead. Tupac bristled at stories that described him as a frightened and demoralized figure who had lost a testicle in a shootout, then been raped in prison, yet continued to sing the praises of Suge Knight and Death Row Records. "There's nobody in the business strong enough to scare me," he boasted in one interview. "I'm with Death Row because they not scared either. When I was in jail, Suge was the only one who used to see me. Nigga used to fly a private plane all the way to New York to spend time with me." Suge, meanwhile, was going ever more public with his thuggery, and Death Row's partners at Interscope seemed not to mind much. Jimmy Iovine would tell federal investigators he was unaware that Michael Harris had bankrolled Death Row's inception until December of 1995, when Harry O. threatened Interscope and Time Warner with a lawsuit that demanded his share of the company's profits. Most people in the record business had been hearing rumors for years that the Ghetto Godfather had financed Death Row's startup, however, and Harry O. himself had sent Iovine a threatening letter in the summer of 1995 that prompted the head of Time Warner's music division, Michael Fuchs, to attempt a prison meeting with Harris. Few employees of Death Row doubted that Iovine was informed when Jake Robles and a group of other bloods showed up at the offices the record label shared with Interscope and literally seized the office of Faye DuVernay, the head of Interscope's rap promotion department. And Iovine, they said, had to know that when DuVernay objected, Suge and his henchmen responded by dragging the Interscope executive out of a meeting and choking him nearly unconscious in an adjacent office. Suge seemed to believe he could get away with just about anything, more than a few observers said, especially since the appearance of David Kenner at his side. Those who did business with Death Row felt increasing dread. Happy Walters, who managed rap acts like Cypress Hill and House of Pain, was said to have engaged in a shouting match with Suge over who would appear on a soundtrack album. A few days later, while withdrawing money from an ATM machine, Happy disappeared, and terror spread like a virus through the music industry in Los Angeles. Loud Records owner Steve Rifkind, who was said to have engaged in a public dispute with Suge over the group Wu-Tang Clan, reportedly hired Knight's former UNLV football teammate Bigga B as his personal bodyguard, insisting that Bigga escort him between his home and office each morning and evening. Rifkind denied the story, but Bigga B told a reporter that the Loud owner was so scared he wouldn't even go take a piss by himself. Happy Walters turned up several days after his disappearance, wandering the streets incoherent, shaved, and naked, as one report put it, and covered with cigarette burns, according to another. When he was taken to a hospital, Walters claimed he had amnesia and refused to speak Suge Knight's name. The rapper and producer Warren G., angry that he was being robbed of credit by Knight and Dr. Dre, rashly advised an interviewer from The Source that he had made Death Row Records, only to phone the magazine a few days later and plead that the editors not publish his remarks. The quote appeared in print anyway, and soon after, a story spread among Death Row staff that Warren G. had been visited in the middle of the night by several Bloods who stuck guns in his face and warned him to watch what he said. All anyone knew for certain was that Warren G., obviously shaken, began carrying a pair of 9mm pistols. Suge Knight demonstrated an ability to control his employees with more subtle but equally ruthless methods. He brought dozens of rappers and musicians, both aspiring and established, into Death Row studios to collaborate on songs he might or might not use on this record or that one. Very rarely did the unknowns among them ask for or receive contracts, and when the songs did appear on CDs, very few of them asked for money. Advancing their careers in any way they could, most felt, was payment enough. Even stars were kept on short leashes, often working for future considerations that might be some time in arriving. Months after his album Doggy Style rose to the top of the charts, Snoop Dogg still was living in an unfurnished apartment. Suge frequently rented apartments for songwriters, musicians, or singers who showed him talent, and even after their work began to appear on hit records, some continued to exist hand to mouth, depending upon Suge not only for a place to live, but even for food money. For Tupac Shakur, however, Suge spared no expense. Tupac's inclusion in the Death Row roster not only fueled the gaudy opulence that for many young Bloods had become the signal fact of affiliation with the label, but also resulted in an increased definition of the organization's hierarchy. Shortly after signing Tupac, Suge purchased a dozen gold rings that spelled out M.O.B. for Member of the Bloods, one with the letters outlined in diamonds and rubies for himself, five more with just diamonds for his most trusted thugs, and six others in plain gold for executives of lesser status. Suge's gifts of heavy gold medallions, in which the hooded figure in the electric chair, still Death Row's symbol, had been encrusted with rubies and diamonds, marked recipients as members of his inner circle. The red leather chair behind the desk in Knight's office had become the throne of a tyrant, who liked to impress visitors by feeding his piranhas live rats, or bringing his guard dog Damu to a full bristle with a whispered command. Obsessed with the Cuban drug dealer Tony Montana, played by Al Pacino in the film Scarface, Suge began to mimic the character's paranoia, filling a cabinet behind his desk with six television sets that permitted him to surveil virtually every square inch of Death Row's studios. The killing of Kelly Jamerson at the El Rey Theater in March of 1995, followed by Mark Anthony Bell's beating 9 months later, along with persistent rumors that Death Row Records was dealing in drugs and guns, increased scrutiny of Knight and his record label both in the media and among law enforcement. But Suge shrugged off accusations that he was more criminal than businessman, as the gossip of those motivated by either envy or prejudice. There are still individuals in this society who can't stand the thought of a young black person with a gang of money in the bank, he told one interviewer. When the Los Angeles Times reported that Death Row was the subject of a federal investigation into alleged ties with organized crime figures in New York and Chicago, Suge told the paper's reporter, "A black brother from Compton creates a company that helps people in the ghetto, so what does the government do? They try to bring him down. Sometimes people get sacrificed when they stand up. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and now, apparently, Suge Knight. Sometimes they take away your life," Suge told the Times. "Sometimes they take away your freedom. It's sad." Unlike Martin and Malcolm, Suge was lucky in his enemies. Attacks on gangster rap had begun in the early 1990s when a Harlem minister named Calvin Butts organized a protest march outside Sony's headquarters in Midtown Manhattan. After the Reverend changed his mind, however, deciding that rappers were only reflecting the problems of life in the inner city, the cultural right made a gigantic mistake by replacing him with Dr. C. Dolores Tucker, For the 10 or 12 months after Tucker formed the National Political Congress of Black Women in 1993, demanding that corporate America assist in the suppression of this hateful music, the woman enjoyed enormous success. Allied with William Bennett and his Empower America movement, she made appearances on virtually every major television news program, saw her letters printed on the New York Times op-ed page, obtained a position on the NAACP's Board of Trustees, and then used it to prevent the organization from giving Tupac Shakur its 1994 Image Award. After Tucker delivered a 17-minute speech at Time Warner's annual shareholders meeting, the company's executives were so cowed that they decided to sell their 50% interest in Interscope back to Ted Field, who promptly sold the same shares to Edgar Bronfman Jr.'s MCA. An enraged Suge Knight mounted a highly effective counterattack, aided in considerable part by the questionable character of C. Dolores Tucker. At first, Suge's claim that Tucker had asked him to leave Death Row and work for her at a new Time Warner label, promising $80 million and two state-of-the-art recording studios, sounded ludicrous. But as the media learned more about Tucker's background, what Suge said sounded increasingly plausible. Though she called herself Doctor, it turned out that Tucker had no college degree. And while she had indeed been the highest-ranking black woman in the state government while serving as Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Secretary during the 1970s, Tucker also was the subject of a 3-month investigation at the end of her term, in which it was discovered that she had used state employees to write speeches for which she was paid more than $66,000. When Tucker claimed that the FBI, at her instigation, was investigating the sale of gangsta rap records to minors, the agency quickly issued a denial, and her credibility was further undermined. An embarrassed Bill Bennett was already backing away by the time Suge purchased a 2-page ad in The Source that printed a long list of freedom fighters, including Martin Luther King Jr., Harriet Tubman, Nelson Mandela, Marcus Garvey, and others. The name C. Dolores Tucker also appeared on the list, but it had been crossed out by a red line, which among members of the Bloods was a way of marking someone for death. That same month, Suge delivered Snoop Dogg's new album Dog Food to stores on Halloween. Suge thought, "They're all so scared of it, I'll release it on the scariest night of the year," a reporter explained. The album quickly went platinum, and by early 1996, just about everyone in the music industry agreed with what David Geffen told Rolling Stone. The decision to dump Interscope was a gigantic error for Time Warner and a great opportunity for Edgar Bronfman. By February of 1996, as Snoop Dogg sat in a downtown Los Angeles courtroom listening to final arguments at his first-degree murder trial, many of Death Row Records' biggest names had begun to ask themselves where exactly Suge Knight was leading them. "This is some serious shit," said an obviously daunted Snoop outside the courtroom, where he stood wearing a suit and tie that had replaced the flannel shirts he'd worn early in the trial. The charges against the rapper arose from a killing almost 3 years earlier, in which a 20-year-old Ethiopian named Philip Waldemariam was shot in the back by Snoop's bodyguard, McKinley Lee. Apart from Snoop's celebrity, the scenarios of Waldemariam's death offered by both prosecution and defense were depressingly familiar. The incident began outside Snoop's apartment in Palms, each side agreed, when Snoop's friend Sean Abrams flashed a gang sign at Waldemariam as the young Ethiopian and two of his friends drove past. The car stopped, epithets were exchanged, and Snoop's bodyguard Lee ran downstairs to intervene. Waldemariam and friends drove away, but less than an hour later, Snoop was behind the wheel of his Jeep with Lee in the passenger seat and Abrams in the back as they prowled the neighborhood. The three found Waldemariam and his friends at nearby Woodbine Park, where the group was dining on takeout Mexican food. What happened next was a matter of dispute. According to the defense attorneys, David Kenner for Snoop, Johnny Cochran for Abrams, and Donald Ray for Lee, Waldemariam reached for the .38 he wore in his waistband, forcing McKinley Lee to draw his own gun and shoot the Ethiopian in self-defense. The prosecution countered that Snoop and his friends had pursued Waldemariam to the park and that the shots fired by Lee had hit the Ethiopian in his buttocks and back. How could that be self-defense? Apart from Snoop's celebrity status, among those who made an appearance in court to show their support were Suge Knight, MC Hammer, and Tupac Shakur, the defense had three major advantages. The first was Kenner, who hammered at several key prosecution witnesses so relentlessly that jurors sat shaking their heads and suppressing smiles. Secondly, one of Philip Waldemariam's companions astounded the prosecution by changing his story, explaining in court that the Ethiopian had reached for his gun, and that after the shooting, he and Waldemariam's other companion removed the gun from their friend's hand to ensure Snoop's conviction. Thirdly, key evidence in the case that included bloody clothing and shell casings had been destroyed or removed from the property room at the LAPD's Pacific Division. The jury returned not guilty verdicts on all counts. Snoop was collected outside the criminal court's building by a chauffeur-driven Rolls-Royce dispatched by Suge Knight. That evening, Snoop joined Suge and his entourage for a party at Monty's Steakhouse, where guests, who included not only Tupac and Hammer, but also several members of the jury, dined on crab legs and lobster tails. Though all smiles that evening, Snoop was badly shaken by his ordeal. Within a matter of months, he would begin talking about the change of direction that resulted eventually in his parting of the ways with Suge Knight and Death Row Records. Others, though, would leave first. The only performer to meet Suge head-on was RBX, who also happened to be the single Death Row rapper who was a match for him physically. The beef between the two had started in a dressing room at the New Regal Theater on Chicago's South Side, over something so stupid that those who heard the story could barely believe it. Suge had become infuriated when RBX ate some fried chicken Knight had ordered for his homeboys. An incredulous RBX stayed right in Suge's face until Knight pulled out a pistol and handed it to one of his homies. "If I whoop your ass, this nigga's likely to shoot me," RBX observed. Violence was averted when Snoop Dogg reminded Suge that RBX was his cousin and said to please let it pass, but the incident raised serious doubts about Knight's leadership. It had been obvious for some time that Suge was more concerned with how he looked to the Piru Bloods, who made up his entourage, than about maintaining good relations with his performers and musicians. To end his relationship with a rapper who had performed on records that sold millions of copies over nothing more than a few pieces of fried chicken, though, was flat-out insanity. And more than a few people listened when RBX began to say that Suge was not only a bully, but a coward who couldn't fight a man his own size without thugs on hand to make sure he finished on top. The DOC was the next to pull away, explaining that he had relocated to Atlanta because there was too much drama out there in L.A. Soon after, RBX made a final break with Death Row by refusing to perform as the voice of Satan on Snoop's Murder Was the Case, a song about a murdered young man who returns to Earth by making a deal with the devil. RBX signed shortly thereafter with Giant Records, where he promptly recorded an album that attacked Death Row in general and Dr. Dre in particular. Several interviewers would force Dre to acknowledge that the departure of RBX from Death Row was similar to the way he had left Ruthless Records. Snoop Dogg, caught in the middle, broke with RBX and told an interviewer, "This is a family thing on Death Row, and Dre is the godfather." The godfather, however, was no longer happy in the Death Row family either. Dre's life was a debacle, and he had mostly himself to blame. During the past 4 years, he had pleaded guilty to battery of a police officer in New Orleans, escaped criminal assault charges by settling out of court with former Pump It Up hostess Dee Barnes, and pleaded no contest to breaking the jaw of rap producer Damon Thomas. After leading several LAPD squad cars on a high-speed chase that ended when he drove off a cliff, Dre was under house arrest for the third time since October of 1992. He owned a beautiful home in which to serve his confinement, but the place had burned nearly to the ground a few months earlier during a crapulous barbecue at which many of the guests were hardcore gang members. Suge's Bloods had been turning Dre's swim parties into melees for months, deafening neighbors with the thumping bass lines of their music, having public sex with groupies, weaving drunkenly through a neighborhood where most of the homes were surrounded by gates, and turning the living room of Dre's own French colonial into a boxing ring. Jerry Heller, who lived only a few doors down, described driving past when the house caught fire and seeing a drunken Dre in the street, laughing with his friends. Dre moved temporarily into an apartment on Venice Boulevard, but was promptly evicted. Now the 29-year-old Grammy winner, who had just been dubbed by Newsweek the Phil Spector of rap, was living with his mother. Throughout the music industry, Dre was regarded as a talented producer and a dangerous fool. He never had been a real gangbanger, though, and a lot of people who knew Dre well said his personality was softer than that of almost anyone else at Death Row. When a judge threatened to put Dre in L.A. County Jail, Suge Knight told David Kenner, "He can't go in there. Them motherfuckers will kill him. He ain't from the street." Dre finally was ready to agree. In March of 1996, he put in a call to Jimmy Iovine at Interscope, said he wanted out of Death Row, and suggested starting a new label. "I don't like it at Death Row no more," Dre explained to an interviewer. "The mentality there is that you have to be mad at somebody in order for yourself to feel good or make a record." Observers were astonished that Suge accepted Dre's departure, though most understood this better when they learned that Dre had agreed to forfeit an enormous financial stake in the company in order to obtain his freedom. At Death Row, however, Dre became almost as hated an enemy as Puffy Combs during the next few months. Everyone who wanted to stay with the label was required to revile him. All during that spring and into early summer, Tupac Shakur went out of his way to prove his loyalty to Suge by dissing Dre, accusing him in one interview of regularly robbing credit from other producers. "He was owning the company and chilling in his house," Tupac said, "while I'm out here in the streets stomping niggas' asses, starting wars and shit, dropping albums, doing my thing, and this nigga taking 3 years to do one song." Tupac then accused Dre in not one, but two new songs of being a closet homosexual. "Gay-ass Dre," he called his former producer on To Live and Die in L.A. Shakur also joined in a brutal attack on one of Dre's closest friends, producer Sam Snead Anderson. The incident took place at Death Row's offices in Westwood. Snead had been summoned to the meeting supposedly to discuss working on a new album by Snoop Dogg. Things turned nasty very quickly, however, and after Suge accused him of being slick, Snead was certainly beaten and possibly subjected to a sexual assault. "I don't want to go into that," Snead later told an interviewer. "A few people put their hands on me and I lost respect for all of them." What Suge really wanted from Snead, reportedly, was the name of Dr. Dre's homosexual lover. When Snead said he had never even heard that Dre was gay, an entire gang of rappers, Tupac included, fell on him, punching him to the ground, then kicking and stomping at him where he lay rolled up in a ball. "He thought he was about to die," Snead said, but Suge stopped the others short and let him stagger out of the office with his face bathed in blood. Suge continued to harass Dre, phoning his house to demand that he surrender Death Row's master tapes. "Finally, I sent somebody over to Dre's house to get the masters," Suge told the source. "When Dre wouldn't open the door, he went over himself," Suge explained. "I come through the gate, see motherfuckers running and hiding." Eventually, a dozen LAPD squad cars were summoned to the scene. "But it wasn't no thing," Suge said. "I played a couple games of pool, got my shit, and left." Dre's version of the incident was that someone rang his bell, claiming to be Jimmy Iovine. "When he opened the door," Dre said, "in comes Suge with 8 or 9 niggas. Suge said, 'We try to get the tapes.' When he told Suge the tapes were being copied right now," Dre recalled, "Suge said he would wait, then suggested that he put the Death Row logo on his next album. Several days later, the two met at Gladstone's restaurant in Malibu and reportedly worked out their differences. But when Suge was asked about their parting of the ways, he answered, 'The nigga just kind of hid, stopped calling.'" All Dre cared about was that Death Row at last seemed ready to leave him be. Suge couldn't afford to let Tupac Shakur simply walk away, however. Chapter 5. Tupac tipped his hand more by what he did than by anything he said. During early 1996, he insisted upon negotiating his movie deals without Suge Knight's agency. And in February of 1996, Death Row's biggest star formed his own and entirely separate production company, Euphonasia, then brought his old friend Yasmin Fula to L.A. to run the business. From the first, Fula found it difficult to obtain any financial accounting from Death Row Records. Whenever she sent Suge Knight's office a request for documents, Fula said what she received instead were cars and jewelry. She began to feel there was this dark cloud over us, Fula told The New Yorker's Connie Brook. I knew so much was wrong. While Tupac would not let Fula prod Suge Knight with legal threats, he did refuse to let any of his younger cousins sign contracts with Death Row. Tupac also began to rely increasingly on his East Coast attorney, Harvard Law School professor Charles Ogletree, who was frustrated by his dealings with the rapper's Los Angeles lawyer, David Kenner. Since Tupac's finances were entirely controlled by Death Row, he had no choice but to rely on the record company's assistance in settling Tupac's numerous civil lawsuits, Ogletree complained. David Kenner would tell him the check was in the mail, then that it was being sent by FedEx, then that it was being wired. The money never seemed to arrive, however. By that summer, Tupac had become increasingly overt about his plan to escape Death Row. He had a strategy, Ogletree told Connie Brook. The idea was to maintain a friendly relationship with Suge, but to separate his business. That was not a difficult thing to accomplish legally, Ogletree said, but you have to live after that. It was a question of how to walk away with your limbs attached and your bodily functions operating. Tupac and Suge, at least, were still united in hostility toward their rivals at Bad Boy Entertainment. Tupac's first album released by Death Row Records, 1996's All Eyes on Me, sold more than 500,000 copies during its first week in the stores, earning $10 million, second only to the Beatles' anthology as the best commercial opening in the history of the music industry. Executives at other labels were duly impressed, but even more astonished by the vehemence of Tupac's attack on Puffy Combs and East Coast rappers in the song Hit 'Em Up. Especially startling was Tupac's vicious assault on Biggie Smalls, whom he continued to blame for his shooting at Quad Studios. For several months before the album's release, Tupac had been seen at parties in L.A. with Biggie's wife, singer Faith Evans. Evans, who knew that her husband had been carrying on with his former flame Lil' Kim, called Tupac mad cool in one interview and agreed to perform with him on a number for Shakur's new album. Biggie's wife was startled and embarrassed, however, when the song came out with the title, Wonder Why They Call You Bitch. Even more humiliating was Tupac's claim to an interviewer from The Source that he had been sleeping with Faith. Tupac repeated this claim, only much more crudely, on Hit 'Em Up. I fucked your bitch, you fat motherfucker. Biggie handled the attendant publicity with an impressive aplomb. If honey was to give you the pussy, he told an interviewer, why would you disrespect her like that? If you had a beef with me and you're like, boom, I'ma fuck his wife, why would you be so harsh on her? Like you got a beef with her. That shit doesn't make sense. Little more than a month after the release of All Eyes on Me, Biggie came to Los Angeles to accept an award at the 1996 Soul Train Awards, and in his speech, thanked Brooklyn. Loud jeers erupted from the Death Row section of the audience. Afterward, Biggie and Tupac came face to face for the first time in almost 2 years. When he looked in Tupac's eyes, Biggie said, I thought, yo, this nigga is really bugging the fuck out. Suge Knight was at Tupac's side, and both were surrounded by a security squad of bad-looking bloods as they began to shout, we gonna settle this right now. Bad Boy rapper Lil Cease shouted from behind the Southside Crips who were working security for Biggie, fuck you, nigga, East Coast, motherfucker. Tupac yelled back, we on the West Side now, we gonna handle this shit. As the two sides faced off, one of the Crips drew a gun, and the crowd scattered from the clutch of scuffling, shouting gangbangers. Puffy ran away, his bodyguard Eugene Deal would recall. He said after, I'm tired of this. I won't live my life like this. He says, I don't give a fuck if Tupac gotta die. I don't give a fuck if Big gotta die. After the incident, both Biggie and Puffy admitted that the East Coast-West Coast feud was real, a point that had been driven home when Tupac sent a hand-delivered letter reading, West Side Up, to the Bad Boy offices. Tupac ain't mad at the niggas that shot him, Combs told an interviewer. He knows where they're at. He knows who shot him. If you ask him, he knows, and everybody in the street knows, and he's not stepping to them because he knows he can't get away with that shit. To me, that's some real sucker shit. Suge replied that the feud wasn't between the East and West Coasts, but between ghetto niggas and phony niggas. Puffy, he said, was a phony nigga. He's frontin', trying to be something he ain't. Here's the whole thing with Puffy. They say shit to make themselves bigger. I ain't never did no interview saying shit about people. By saying shit about Death Row in magazines, they trying to put themselves on our level, and it ain't no motherfucking comparison. Suge's proposed solution to the conflict was to put Puffy and Tupac in a boxing ring together. Look at Puffy's body, Knight said. Who can he whoop? How you gonna talk shit and be in a girl's body? And I'll beat Biggie's ass all over the ring. We can do it in Vegas and give the money to the ghetto. In April of 1996, Suge upped the ante by announcing that Death Row Records intended to open an East Coast division in Manhattan. Tupac advised a radio station in Oakland that Suge meant to sign New York-based acts like Big Daddy Kane and Wu-Tang Clan. Observing from the sidelines, Dr. Dre commented, "If it keeps up this way, pretty soon niggas from the East Coast ain't gonna be able to come out here and vice versa." Suge Knight, however, brought a huge entourage with him to New York for the MTV Awards show on September 7th. The group made an aggressively grand entrance, stalking past the music industry executives, some of them presidents of other labels, who waited in line with tickets in hand, to take seats without delay. After the show, the Death Row group had to be separated from Bad Boy's contingent by more than 20 NYPD officers. Only a few weeks earlier, Puffy Combs had made his most ominous comments on the East versus West feud in an interview with Vibe. "Bad boys move in silence. If somebody wants to get your ass, they're gonna wake up in heaven. There ain't no record gonna be made about it. It ain't gonna be no interviews. It's gonna be straight up. Oh shit, where am I? What are these, wings on my back?" Puffy had ended the interview by telling Vibe, "I'm ready for this beef to come to a head, however it got to go down. I'm ready for it to be out of my life and be over with." Tupac Shakur seemed finally to feel the same way. His decision to leave Death Row had changed him, according to his fiancée, Kidada Jones, whose father, Quincy Jones, owned Vibe. "Tupac was tired of the lifestyle he had been sharing with Suge Knight," Kidada said. Instead of hanging out at strip clubs, she told an interviewer, Tupac had taken up cooking. After finishing his next album, the last he owed Death Row Records under the contract he had signed in the prison at Dannemora, Kidada said, Tupac might sign with Warner Brothers. Her boyfriend also intended to move out of the house Death Row had leased for him and settle with her in another part of town, perhaps father a child. Any doubt about Tupac's intention to break with Death Row had been removed on August 27th, when the rapper made the move that a lot of people predicted would get him killed, firing David Kenner as his attorney. Outside the MTV Awards show 1 week later, Tupac seemed intent upon defusing rather than escalating the East versus West feud. "We are businessmen. We are not animals," he told the interviewer for a film crew, who asked what would happen if Death Row met Bad Boy inside. "It's not like we're going to see them and rush them and jump on them." As word that Tupac Shakur had discharged David Kenner spread through the music industry, Suge Knight insisted the problem was between the two of them and that he had no hard feelings toward Tupac. At the MTV Awards in New York, Suge invited Tupac to join him in Las Vegas for the Mike Tyson-Bruce Seldon heavyweight title fight 3 days later on September 7th. Tupac seemed to sense that his attendance would put him at risk, and on the morning of the 7th, he told Yasmin Fula that instead he would go to Atlanta to deal with some problems among his relatives. During the next several hours, Suge Knight convinced Shakur to change his mind and go to Las Vegas after all. But Tupac confided to Kidada Jones that he still felt uneasy about the trip. She advised him to wear his bulletproof vest, but Tupac said the weather was too hot for that. Late that afternoon, he boarded a flight to Vegas and said goodbye to Los Angeles for the last time.
Context of White Supremacy. So that is our first audio segment. We are still in Chapter 5 for Labyrinth by Randall Sullivan. Gus T. Renegade, Context of White Supremacy. The number to dial if you have thoughts, questions, observations. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. It seemed like we heard, remember last week I went through, I think it was Mo in Dallas, he asked, how many times is the word nigger in the book? Let me see, or nigger, any of the derivatives. And I looked, it's 27 times. 27 times, that's it. And I said, wow, it seems like we heard it about 10, 15 times last week. And it seems like we heard it about a good 10 times this week. And I said, after chapter 5, we're in chapter 5 now, it's in there like two more times and that's it. So we can think of that or process that however we need to. Let's see. One of our investors wrote in. This is chapter 4. Greetings, Gus. Chapter 4. Number 1. His mother enrolled him in the city's Baltimore School for the Arts, where he studied ballet, poetry, jazz, and acting. The global system of racism, white supremacy turns talented young black males into monsters and monstrosities in spite of the constructive efforts of attempted parents. Absolutely. Number 2. Suge, obsessed with the Cuban drug dealer Tony Montana, played by Al Pacino in the film Scarface. Interesting how so many rappers like the names of white gangsters, Capone, Gotti, Dillinger, Siegel, I suppose seeking in a subliminal manner white validation. Ask Mr. Fuller about that, because he's talked about Godfather and a lot of these same films that a lot of black people victims adore, and white people do too. And some of that is just, I mean, a lot of white people love The Godfather and Scarface and all of those movies and such. But he also said it's just being childish, you know, being childish, watching a whole lot of TV and seeing these folks that are supposed to be powerful and, oh, I wish I could be like them. Go, you knock off a few folks and all that nonsense. Number 3, an enraged Suge Knight mounted a highly effective counterattack, aided in part by questionable characters of C. Dolores Tucker. Tucker had no college degrees, subject of a 3-month investigation. She attended both Temple University and the University of Pennsylvania without graduating. Oh, I was going to say like Mark Furman, but Mark Furman didn't attend a university. He attended 3 different community colleges without graduating. The ultimate reason she did not complete either program, I suspect, is due directly or indirectly to racist man and racist woman, for sure. Chapter 5, Tupac's 1996, All Eyes on Me, earning $10 million, second only to the Beatles' anthology, as the best commercial opening in the history of the music industry. A lot of suspected racists bought his music to hear him talk about wanting to fight and kill other black people. Yes. Number 2. Oh, wait a minute. That's gone too far. Gone too far. Have to stop, get the rest of his chapter 5 thoughts as we move forward. Number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I guess folks can let us know if you've seen City of Lies, the adaptation, film adaptation of this text, as we proceed as well. Let's see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Athena Shakur having an affair with Malcolm X's bodyguard in her early years. Now, I don't know much about that. Was the bodyguard married? If somebody can let me know, that's, you know, technically that's not an affair. So I wonder why he used that, term, her having an affair with Malcolm X's bodyguard, and who's the bodyguard. I don't know if it's, you know, an issue of, you know, naming or something like that, but I thought that was pretty interesting. But like I said, if I'm wrong about that, you know, please correct me on that. Charges of aggravated assault were only dropped when it came out that the cops Tupac had shot were a pair of drunken yahoos who had started things by brandishing a pistol stolen from a precinct evidence room. Now, I thought that was real interesting that he called these cops drunken yahoos. And I was wondering, what was the purpose behind that? These two were actually law enforcement officers, race soldiers, actually, that Tupac had shot. So why would he minimize it by calling them drunken yahoos? I didn't get that. Letters to Tupac in prison about Biggie's involvement in his shooting. It sounds like the same tactics that we read about with COINTELPRO. Letters, inciting hatred and revenge on somebody. It seems like that COINTELPRO was, proven to at least go up until the 90s. So I think those letter writing campaigns were actually still going on while Tupac was in jail. Also, being mistreated, probably, drugged. Obviously he said he was being raped. So, that whole prison system, was definitely, definitely breaking him down. He mentioned the album Dog Food, but he also mentioned Snoop Dogg being the artist. That is incorrect. The artist on that album was the Dog Pound, not Snoop Dogg. I don't know who his, proofwriters are, but they need to, do a better job of naming the artist albums. That was the Dog Pound, not Snoop Dogg, who did Dog Food. And Charles Ogletree, I saw that name before and I looked it up, and sure enough, that was the Harvard professor that actually taught Barack and Michelle Obama at Harvard Law School. So, but that's all I have on Meet My Life.
Much obliged, Henry, in Chicago. Words are very important. I don't have enough information myself about that. I don't even know what to call it. Is that rumor? Is that supposition? There are no footnotes. Dr. Afeni Shakur Davis, I guess, hyphen, and a so-called affair with some of Malcolm X's security personnel. Like, I had not heard that before. He didn't name the person. As you said, interesting word choice. Was this security personnel, was he married at the time? Like, why? All of that. I would like a lot more information. Lots more information. And the why. Why the word affair right there? Much obliged. And the correction, whoever did the editing for Randall Sullivan's work. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Greetings. I'm here.
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I guess I would have problems reporting on this book. It's not difficult to understand, but from the standpoint, the first word I want to just mention is insanity. I think that's the best word I can think of as in term from what I just heard of. As a way of living, as far as how the reader was explaining the lives of these personalities, I would find it very difficult to live from day to day. Although, if the writer, the author of this book, and the reader of the book, the same, is that the same person?
No, sir.
Oh, it's not. Okay, well, the person who's doing the reading sounds like a white person. Am I correct on that?
I've not seen a photograph of the narrator, so I'll have to see if we can get a visual, and then I'll let you know, but I'm not for sure.
Okay, okay, because I wouldn't mind him being on the cows, and if it was a white person and asked him a question about did he have fun in his reading of the book. It sounds like a white person, and you know, with the number of times that he used the word nigga. And to me, it's no difference between whether it's G-A or E-R. I don't care on how somebody else defines the terms. Yeah, the history, you know, a little bit of history in the beginning. Single out Tupac's mom, just like a lot of parents. They don't want their child or children to, if it's a non-white person under the global system of racist white supremacy, especially, don't want their child or children to grow up in the same fashion that they grew up, and they work to and try to improve on their child's what they come in contact with. I can almost see her efforts on the process. I've always known her as a very smart, very witty a person, especially with her part in the situation that took place in New York when she was with the Black Panther Party. I think she was instrumental in the process of them being ruled not guilty. She was an important part in that case. And I would say that he probably got a lot of that personality of hers with him also, as far as what others that I've heard have witnessed from that standpoint. With the two fashions, what my mind keeps telling me is like two media groups that happens to, you know, with the selling of the genre that's called rap, that just, you know, finding a way to fuss and fight and kill one another. I mean, I can see white people promoting that. I can see white people promoting something like that. The writer has, as a white person, has his own special way of reporting it. I can sense that it's a white person that's in charge of this particular narrative, so to speak. But nevertheless, it's a lot of incorrectness, a lot of a lot of crazy, you know, like I said, the word insanity is the best word I can think of right now. And that's all I would say. Thanks for listening.
Can I be heard?
We can hear you. Rob in sunny Southern California. Just give me 1 second before you proceed. So the author for the book we are reading is Randall Sullivan, white man, suspected racist. So he's in charge of all the words we got and why nigger is in the book so many times, nigga or nigger or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Randall Sullivan. However, the narrator, and Gussie has said this many times over the years, especially about the last year, like, ooh-wee, that paying, listening to someone's voice and trying to pick out their racial classification, everybody is much worse at this than they think. It's not reliable at all. The author, at least it would seem to me, Kevin Free, is a black male. So I don't know how a black person would feel about reading this, enjoy or not, but maybe he has a white parent. I don't know, but he no pass, no nothing like that. This is a black male narrator, Kevin R. Free, and then it has his extensive bio for all the different books that he has read, including this one. So we have a white author, Randall Sullivan, but a black male, non-white narrator, Kevin Free. And people can look him up online. He has his own website, kevinrfree.com. Let's see. Rob.
Okay. I wasn't 100% sure.
Very few people are.
I wasn't sure.
Everybody makes lots of errors with that, including Gus. We're trying to guess out folks on how they sound and voice. Like, oh, man, it's always good to ask. Let's see. Rob in Southern California. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, listeners and callers. I have rather been enjoying this book because this is the genre of music that was very popular when I was in high school. Very specifically, I can remember, and the internet was not functioning at this point, and I can remember going to school one day, and when I got out of school, the song Hit 'Em Up was like for sale at record stores. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was an actual tape, you know. And at that time, it was like one of the best things I had ever heard. Like I can remember being very excited about it. Like, being so excited at having, I guess, like a, how would I describe it? Having a platform, you know, and or a, an ally and one opposing their enemy. And that's kind of like what the song was. And so now with the reading and part one, it's very interesting, like, to be living in that time. And that was the popular music when I was a youth. To hear that the CIA was involved with the record company, and to hear the record company probably orchestrated the death of Tupac Shakur, that is very very eye opening, and it's kind of like very eye opening. It's very shocking, and it's very revealing of the system. And transitioning from a younger male to an older male now, like, I can really see where the hand of white supremacy was, like, basically had a knee on my neck, like, and had me operating in, like, just total foolishness. Like, I can remember, actually, like, when that song Hit 'Em Up came out and that East Coast, West Coast beef thing, like, started, like, people in the street was actually taking sides. You know, like, depending on, like, where you were and, like, who you was rotating with or whatever, like, people were picking the East Coast or the West Coast. And it's very, like, shocking to me, like, just to reveal, like, how big of a star Tupac Shakur was, because there was no internet at this time. And he was just such a bright, bright star. And it's such a just a great loss, and thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Rob. For this one, I got to say it the other way, because what you just said—that's significant. Wasn't Rob in SoCal? This was Rob in Wisconsin, where he's talking about Hit 'Em Up came out, and he remembers being excited about it, and people taking Rob in Wisconsin, remembering people taking side. Which side do you take in Wisconsin? is that you just pick whichever person you like, or we're close enough? Like, come on. Let's see. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let me get to my notes. If folks have seen the film City of Lies, wow, that is like to compare and contrast as we proceed. Like, it's not the FX People vs. O.J. Simpson type excitement, but as we continue to read this and then to watch that, like, wow, especially since it's being heavily promoted, this film. Anywho, let's see. Looking at my notes. So they start out, we read Assata Shakur's autobiography way back in 2015. Let's see. Inadmissible Evidence, her aunt, if I'm remembering correctly, Evelyn Williams, attorney at law. She also wrote a book, Inadmissible Evidence. Lots more details about that case. And her Afeni Shakur as well. Let's see. Okay, this book, we're supposed to be getting Randall Sullivan, supposed to be a spectacular journalist, written for Rolling Stone and all the rest, right? Wrote this book. So he writes, Tupac's godfather, Elmer Geronimo Pratt, we just read about him, was convicted in 1968 of murdering a school teacher during a robbery in Santa Monica and sentenced to life in prison. The boy's aunt, in quotes, Assata Shakur, Joanne Chesimard, was found guilty in 1977 of murdering a New Jersey state trooper, though she did manage to break out of prison 2 years later and flee to Cuba. Tupac's stepfather, Matulu Shakur, was found guilty of conspiring in that prison escape as well as in the attempted robbery of a Brinks armored car in which two police officers and a guard were killed. Okay, now, just in that section, Geronimo Pratt is never mentioned again in this book. That, in my view, is a gargantuan act of white supremacy racism. By the time this book was published, 2001, even if it was 2000, Geronimo Pratt had been released, and the context of that release is important for this book because we would have, once again, LAPD, LA District Attorney's Office. Man, are you all engaging in corrupt behavior, lying, falsely charging, falsely accusing a black male, and seemingly unconcerned about getting the perpetrators? You lied for 25 years, saying Geronimo Pratt participated in the Santa Monica killing, and then he did not. Where are the real killers at? We don't know. So that's number one. I would say at minimum, it's sloppy journalism, but beyond that, and because that has relevance for this case, you got some of the same people involved, Johnny Cochran in the middle, and some of the same allegations of, man, LAPD corrupt behavior and racism, white supremacy. That's way beyond just sloppy journalism, Randall Sullivan. That's, you're practicing white supremacy racism, because to me, this whole section where it's like, oh man, let's give you the rap sheet on all of Tupac Shakur's no-count relatives. We got his crackhead mother and her affairs, and then we got Geronimo Pratt, a murderer. He was exonerated, but we're not going to mention that. And we just continue going down the line, Matulu Shakur, and he's a no-count this. Not that he's an acupuncturist and did all this about health and prosperity. Nah. Very interesting way to present a lot of information. Even the fact he has the boy's aunt, in quotes, like, we want to say that, like, dang, you can't just be, this is a godparent, a family, someone who functioned in the capacity of an aunt when we have decimated families. It can't be that. Even that felt pejorative to me, to put it in quotes. But okay, let's continue. Let's see. I said one of the major themes, at least of the last two books, and maybe all three, emasculation, homoeroticism directed at black males has come up in so many different ways and so intensely in this book, and I'd say especially this week. So we start off, I remember crying all the time. Tupac told an interviewer about his early childhood. No footnotes again. Where is this at? Maybe we want to go and get more information to read about all this. My major thing growing up was that I just couldn't fit in. Baltimore would be good to the boy, though. His mother enrolled him in the city's School for the Arts, where he studied ballet, poetry, jazz, and acting. He performed in Shakespearean plays and played Mouse King in The Nutcracker. The teenager, who had been teased about his slight build and effeminate features in New York, would say that he finally felt in touch with himself during his time at the School for the Arts. Number one, the system of white supremacy deliberately set up to make sure that black people do not have access to this sort of academic environment, non-white people in general, but especially black people and black boys in particular. I don't think Baltimore is good for black people. I don't think the system of white supremacy, but especially not Baltimore, like Freddie Gray, lead poisoning, like, you seen The Wire? Let's see. And effeminate features, like, wow. Now that, we could spend a whole lot of time on that. Why is that? Removal of black males? What do you mean when you say effeminate features? Like, lots and lots of times, but again, black misandry, removal of black male. That's really a lot of what we've been reading about in these three books. Removal of black males placed in prison, O.J. Simpson a father, Geronimo Pratt a father. Tupac didn't have time to be a father. Notorious B.I.G. didn't have time to be a father. Kevin Gaines, a father. At one level, that's what we're talking about here. Black misandry. Let's see. They go to the next, and this continuing, I guess, either have the heart of a killer or expect to be treated like any other sucker. Fair game for anyone who was bad enough to take the watch off your wrist or the money from your pocket. Now, I thought all of that should be, hey, this is black people terrorizing other black people. They're not doing this to white people who have way better things to take and way more things to take. No, no, no. This is, I'm badder than you, person classified as black nigger, nigga, whatever you want to say. But just niggers. This is not, you know, I'm going to go be bad and take all the white people stuff out in Rodeo. Nah. So, at 5'8 and 150 pounds, with fine, soft features, I don't know what that means, and eyes that just wouldn't go dead, I have no idea what that means. Like, man, I guess I'm not an attractive fella, so I don't have those eyes that just won't go dead. But what does that mean? Like, help me out. Let's see. Tupac scared absolutely nobody, at least not until he bought his first pistol and began practicing with it at a local firing ranges, and even then, not scaring white people at all. Let's see. He says Tupac's first major brush with the law made headlines that summer when he went home to attend the celebration of Marin City's 50th anniversary and got into a shooting match with some young men from the neighborhood that did not end until shots were fired at a six-year-old boy, and a six-year-old boy was killed by a bullet to the head. He doesn't explain, did Tupac do the shooting? Did Tupac have a gun? Did Tupac shoot the boy? Like, not enough detail at all. John Patash, in the same interview that I sound clipped the intro to today's segment, John Patash described this Marin City incident as the first assassination attempt on Tupac Shakur, and talking about how he literally had to run for his life. They didn't prosecute the people who were shooting at him. In his book, and he talked about it in detail, but just meant like if I had read this and I didn't know all of that other information, if we hadn't read Geronimo Pratt, I would be reading this thinking, wow, Geronimo Pratt is a convicted killer. Like, my goodness, like this Tupac, I don't know, I'm gonna have to rethink it. Released again, this is so egregious. He was already out of prison by the time this book was published. Let's see. N I even got another N I, excuse me, it's N period I period G period G period A period Z period. So we even got another nigger in there that probably was not included in the count because of the spelling. And then I talked about it last week. He said penitentiary niggers, and he had that in quotes. And then this week he comes around, he says the attendant publicity made Tupac simultaneously a media villain and a ghetto champion. What is a ghetto champion? That's one where, to me, it would have been exactly the same if he had said nigger champion, nigger champion, negro champion, whatever. Like, what is a ghetto champion? I've never even heard that term used. If we have any ghetto champions out there, please dial in *61 and explain, what is that? What qualifies you as a ghetto champion? Sullivan goes on, he says, Tupac, charges of aggravated assault. Oh my God, the Atlanta. Talk about, man, Randall Sullivan would have got me. He would have. I'm going to read what Randall Sullivan did, wrote about the Atlanta incident with these yahoos, correctly pointed out by Henry in Chicago. And then I'm going to switch and I'm going to read what John Patash wrote about the Atlanta incident, which he describes, I think by this point, he says, I don't even know, but this is, you know, on a list of where there seemed to be at least four or five different attempts on Tupac Shakur's life. This Atlanta shooting would seem to be at least number two or three. So Sullivan writes, charges of aggravated assault were dropped only when it came out that the cops Tupac had shot were a pair of drunken yahoos. Yahoo existed. Rob in California, well, at the time, Wisconsin. He was correct. Tupac was huge, no internet. By the time this book was published, we had internet, so Yahoo was enormous. To write this and call these officers yahoos, people don't even use that term that much. I mean, Gulliver's Travels is old. People don't even, I don't hear that term in use very regularly. There would be another term for people. You've got, and it's, let me finish reading what he says. Charges of aggravated assault were dropped only when it came out that the cops Tupac had shot were a pair of drunken yahoos who had been started things by brandishing a pistol stolen from a precinct evidence room, and that on the day of Tupac's first court hearing, one of them had been charged with aggravated assault, while both were accused of using the word niggers in a police report. Now, this Mark Furman, again? Maybe they dropped out of community college too. Now I'm going to switch and read what John Patash wrote about this same incident. In fact, John Patash has an entire chapter in his book about this Atlanta shooting, as opposed to this one little blurb that's not even a full paragraph. So, matter of fact, very beginning of the chapter, Patash says, one of the most straightforward police attempts to murder Tupac Shakur occurred in 1993. Tupac had recently moved to Atlanta, buying a house for his mother and sister. He partly did this to be near his business manager, Watani Tahemba, who also helped lead the New African People's Organization. From there, witnesses support that off-duty cops shot at Tupac after the unarmed rapper finished a Halloween night concert at an Atlanta college. The incident started as Tupac drove back from his performance. Tupac's car, followed by an entourage of 3 to 6 cars, stopped at a traffic light near a hotel driveway. A black driver with no connection to Tupac said he pulled into that driveway to turn around when two white cops on foot in civilian clothes with two women screamed racial slurs at the black driver. One of the cops also punched him. Footnote, I'm just not reading it. White and black bystanders at the scene, among others, said that Tupac rolled down his window and asked what was going on. Marvin Gaye. When one of the white men took out a gun, Tupac rolled his window back up. A white couple also stopped at the traffic light in their car, said they saw a group of whites run over to Tupac's car looking like a white gang. They didn't say white yahoos. They said looking like, and this is in quotes, a white gang attacking a black man. One of the men broke Tupac's passenger window with the butt of his gun and shot at him. Footnote, I'm just not reading it. The Tupac rolled out of his car in time to avoid getting shot. The off-duty cop, firing his gun, brought Tupac's security guards out of their cars. Tupac grabbed one of their guns and fired 3 shots back. The people exiting the entourage of several cars sent the white group running, with the gunman reportedly running partially backwards, still aiming behind him at Tupac. Tupac's shots hit the two men in the leg, butt, and back. Police arrested Tupac for attempted homicide. Footnote: the white officers said one of the women was, one of the officers' wives, and the black motorist nearly hit her, but the woman would never speak to this. Those officers also made conflicting reports. They first wrote a police report that described Tupac's group responding to the incident as "niggers came by and did a drive-by shooting." They then changed to Tupac's group getting out of their cars, surrounding and threatening them, then shooting at them. Footnote: many aspects of the incident and post-shooting events contradict the police account and support that police planned this attempt to kill Tupac. During the entire conflict, the officers never identified themselves as police. Footnote: the officers also discredited themselves by lying and saying they didn't have a gun on them that night. Furthermore, immediately after the incident, Atlanta police went directly to Tupac's hotel room to arrest him, despite that Tupac had resigned or registered himself in six rooms under aliases. Such an action supports that he was under close police surveillance. Footnote: most importantly, prosecution dropped their charges against Tupac when the biggest revelations came to light in court. The state's prosecutor's own witness said that the gun one of the cops used on Tupac had been taken from the other cop's police evidence locker. Footnote: in another trial, a police supervisor explained that officers use such throwaway guns, in quotes, for the ease of hiding them after killing someone. Footnote: I'll end with a footnote since we don't have any of those in Mr. Sullivan's book. But do you see that now? I mean, I contend Mr. Sullivan is practicing white supremacy racism. Anyone connected with promoting this book and the subsequent film, there's no way you're going to tell me that they're too lazy to do the research to get this information. John Patash's book wasn't published at this time. But, as I said, Geronimo Pratt had been released from jail. They quote the, or they don't quote the LA Times, but I'm sure they know of the LA Times. So they could have read a few articles and included extra information that, oh, it seems maybe Geronimo Pratt didn't commit these crimes. And they certainly could have got an Atlanta Constitution Journal or Atlanta Journal Constitution and got information. Oh, wow. These cops were not just drunken yahoos, that this may have been another assassination attempt involving enforcement officials. That would be central to the theme of the book, right? That's what he's alleging, right? Off-duty police officers might have been involved in this. Hey, might have been the same thing in Atlanta. Maybe he could have emphasized that. Nah. And these were white officers. Nah. We just want to call them yahoos and get back to no-count Kevin Gaines. If we had read this book early on, like, wow, same thing I think we said about Jeffrey Toobin. Like, ooh, I'd have been like a whole lot of other folks. It's three yeses. O.J. Simpson killed all those people in the yard. Yep. Biggie participated in killing Tupac. Yep. And then Suge Knight and company, they killed Tupac for revenge. Yep. Next in the footnotes, if we got Ghetto Champion, that would be good. Man, how does he say it in every program? He says, sobriety would be best for victims of white supremacy racism. Mr. Patash has another book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, and he talks a lot about, man, a lot of the Dr. Huey P. Newton, Dr. Afeni Shakur Davis, right here in Seattle, Jimi Hendrix, a lot of these black people that were trying to do, Old Dirty Bastard even, a lot of these black people that were trying to do activist work, work against racism, white supremacy, attempted counter-racists, man, we need to get a fifth of this and an ounce of this and let's legalize this and get you a few shots of this. Anything, get that brain computer messed up. Like, we don't need you thinking correctly. Like, come on, we got to retard your development somehow. Keep saying this in the book over and over. Tupac was smoking pot. Tupac was drinking. Tupac was smoking pot. John Patash talked about that. In fact, Tupac talked about it. It's in one of the documentaries where he said at around this time of the shooting and the court case, he said he was smoking lots of cannabis, probably other things. Dr. Welsing would say, I'm pretty sure Mr. Shakur didn't grow this cannabis. Who knows what's in it? Where did you get it from? Who knows? What did they put in it? Who knows? Where did they get it from? Who knows? Sobriety would be best. And then at this time, you're doing all these drugs and could be paranoid at this time. Hey, I think Biggie. And the same, the letters, I think Henry in Chicago said something about that. Like, come on, we just heard that. We just heard that. Like, come on. We got all these letters and accusations like, ooh-wee, I heard they was talking about you, and ooh-wee, they said this about you, and ooh-wee, Biggie, yeah, they were going to get you. They did it, man. How are you getting letters in jail about a hit on you? Are you serious? Like, come on. System of racism, white supremacy. They just keep doing the same things. Apparently, we have not learned. Who's more confused about racism? Let's see. Even the way that he tells this narrative that Tupac was smoking pot as he made his way to the Quad recording studio off Times Square. He had been promised $7,000 badly needed dollars for a guest appearance on a song by an obscure Uptown Records rapper named Little Sean. A deal set up through Tupac's new friend Biggie Smalls. Like, ooh, dun dun dun. Like, if they are really this slick and skilled, I can set up a perfect hit. Perfect meaning no conviction, in fact no arrest. Perfect. And well, not totally perfect this time, because well, eventually we're saying they did the final, we successfully eliminate the target and nobody's arrested or charged. Why on earth would we be present? Be someplace else. Like, make sure, like, my goodness, this ends up being the crux. No one has presented any evidence, just the fact that they were here and they seem to be looking odd. Christopher Wallace and Sean Combs looking strange. I don't know how you're supposed to look if someone's been shot. Do you need help? What is going on? What the hell? Like, what? I don't know. What else? Let's call 911. Get help. I don't know what you're supposed to look like, but man, I would not be present if I was participated in any way. Let's make sure we're on the other side of the world having fun. The Godfather, we watch, isn't that what they do? I seen The Godfather. I'm at the church. What are you talking about? Shooting? We push buttons. Mr. Fuller brags about that. What are you talking about? I wasn't even here for the shooting. That's the way you do it. Not be standing upstairs so that the target stumbles out in front of you 5 seconds after it happens. Are they criminal masterminds or not? Make up your mind. Let's see. Now, we heard this last time. I just said Rethinking Rufus. All those times that you hear that the only victims of rape are females. Not in the system of white supremacy. The man not delectable Negro. We've talked about this many times over the years and repeatedly coming up in the book club. And especially in this text, but I mean consecutively with Geronimo Pratt's text and then this one. So you write, as his single Dear Mama rose on the charts, a rumor spread on the streets that he had been raped in Rikers by members of a Latin gang. Now, remember all those times when reading Geronimo Pratt's biography that they would try to get the Mexican gangs to carry out their assassination plots against Geronimo Pratt? Remember that? So I'm not saying it happened or not. I'm just noting the similarity. Using other victims in these incidents. If it did happen, we'll get these so-called Latinos to go in here and sodomize, sexually terrorize Tupac Shakur, another form of torture and terrorism. We've done that for a long time. Maybe it did happen, maybe it did. Even spreading that rumor that it happened, that has a psychological impact. And you can add that double, them saying he had his testicles shot off. So there you have it both ways, that he's been emasculated, he's been raped, and he doesn't even have his testicles anymore. Let's see. And incidentally, they were spreading rumors saying that Diddy, Big, shot you, bragging about it, got this song, Who Shot You? There are so many rap songs, Shot You and Who Shot, I mean, it's about 50,000 of them. Like, are you serious? Take something as goofy as that and, oh, and again, I mean, hey, if you're being raped, you're in prison, no food, cavity searches, not thinking correctly, can be really easy, really to target all of that frustration and anger in one direction, particularly if it's a black person. Let's see. He says it again. Tupac was spending his days and most of his nights as well at Death Row Studio in Tarzana, where producers were amazed by the facility with which he wrote and recorded rap lyrics despite being high on marijuana and drinking heavily most of the time. Tupac bristled at stories that described him as a frightened and demoralized figure who had lost a testicle in a shootout, then been raped in prison, yet continued to sing the praises of Suge Knight and Death Row Records. Black misandry, rethinking Rufus. Psychological torture techniques, really, especially. Why do you keep hearing all these rumors about raping people? And I mean, this sounds like total, like, Guantanamo Bay, like, operations that are happening here. Let's see. Suge seemed to believe he could get away with just about anything, more than a few observers said, especially since the appearance of David Kenner at his side. I thought that was so important. This white man, that something about him having this white man with me, I feel like I can do anything. Why would that be? What's so special about this white man? Does anybody else have a white man that you feel like if this white man is with me? Law schmaw. If I need to tell you to pull down your pants so that I can anally rape you, I got my white friend with me? I'll rape you in public and no one will do anything about it. I don't have white friends like that. Not that I'm into sodomizing folks, but I don't have white friends where I can just go break the law with impunity like that. And if I did, we're in a system of white supremacy, so hey, the person to blame then is the person classified as white. Why in the world are you allowing Suge Knight to go around and do these things? Let's see. Happy Walters, who managed rap acts like Cypress Hill and House of Pain, was said to have engaged in a shouting match with Suge over who would appear on a soundtrack album. A few days later, while withdrawing money from an ATM machine, Happy disappeared and terror spread like a virus through the music industry in Los Angeles. They do actually have an LA Times report talking about his disappearance and him having amnesia. He went to the ATM machine and didn't know what happened, woke up in the bushes and asked for help. Another one of those rumors, who knows? Again, if this is happening, if Suge Knight can go and kidnap people and drug them and torture them and rape them and all the other things, especially when he has his white homie with him, why in the world is that? Like, what? You have a white friend who's not hooking you up with businesses and, you know, deals to help you save money and get a new mortgage and that's a, no. You get a white friend so that you can go around and terrorize and bully black people. Your black business partners, as it were. Okay. Let's see. Anything else? We got the correction on the dog food album. And even the title, like I said, the branding, like, look at the content of all of this from David Kenner. What is all this for? To put out rap albums where you can talk about sleeping with some, having an affair with some black person's partner. You can talk about how other black people that you can't stand and don't like and want to beat up and kill. Put out albums for black people, product for black people, I'm not even going to call it music, put out sounds for black people, call it dog food. call each other bitches and dogs and all the rest of it. Call our names even. Snoop Dogg and all the rest of it. And these are my friends, the Dog Pound. This is our album, Dog Food. That's what you all consume and listen to. From a label, again, Death Row. And they brag about that. Put big medallions and chains with a black male, Black Miss Andrea, black male in the death chair. Like, just think of that, and then have millions of, and why would white people be so enamored with this? Like, think about that again. Now, black people call themselves bitches and dogs and hoes, and, oh, okay, and all these black people, I don't like you, no count nigger, I'll kill you, and blah, blah, blah. Oh, okay, and then they got a black male in a death, electric chair, excuse me. Black male with a hood on in the electric chair. Why would young white people love content like that? Huh. Huh. Let's see. And then, wait a minute. Murder Was the Case. That was one of Snoop Dogg's big hits. They had him perform that live on MTV. So RBX, he challenges Suge Knight. They get into a dispute over fried chicken, according to Randall Sullivan, with no footnotes. RBX made a final break with Death Row by refusing to perform as the voice of Satan on Snoop's Murder Was the Case. Again, now, what sort of content is being produced by white man David Kenner at Death Row Records? Satan has to be voiced on the product by a black person. Let's see. Dark Clouds, lots of those. Suge Knight in the Shadows. I can end here about any doubt about Tupac's intention to break with Death Row had been removed on August 27 when the rapper made the move that a lot of people predicted would get him killed, firing David Kenner as his attorney. Now, why is this white man so powerful that if he's around Suge Knight, I can do anything, break any laws, and never go to prison? Suge Knight decides he wants to fire me. People fire their attorney all the time. Geronimo Pratt, every other page, right, was talking about firing his incompetent attorney, Stuart Hanlon, not Johnny Cochran. So what's the big deal? People fire their lawyers all the time. Move on, get a new client. Firing David Kenner, white man, and people predicted, he's going to, and then he died days later. I mean, that alone should be, whoa. Why would that be? How would people be predicting, you fire that white man and you're going to die, and then days later he does die. Wow. Who is David Kenner? Maybe we should be reading that book instead of this one with David Kenner's name isn't even on the front of it. It's all about Death Row and all that. David Kenner is the power behind Death Row, not Suge Knight. He said Suge Knight was powerful, but he needed this white man. Why isn't David Kenner's name on the front of the book? His picture's not even there. Let's see. The person... We're about to push off the second audio second. I just want to make sure we nab this one caller, and then we'll get there. 11:59. Do you have a comment before we get to the second audio?
Greetings, guys, and greetings, everyone. This text is a at first is a giant example of perhaps a white person practicing racism. Randy Sullivan, with him withholding a ton of information, I suspect, because if he's allegedly this well-renowned journalist, he should definitely know about COINTELPRO and how Geronimo Pratt was involved in that. And I may have missed this part, or I may have not happened, but I haven't heard any mentioning of the CIA being associated with Death Row, and also law enforcement also being attached to that record label, and how suspect that is. And also, I think this is a really tragic example of how victims are trained to just pretend to be so many things that they're not, like hardcore gangbangers, like the most hardcore gangbangers are white people. Like you mentioned earlier, like to be dogs and want to be associated with some sort of dog pound. And to just the schwafisms with all the jewelry, money, time and energy spent on material trinkets and stuff like that. And highly, highly suspicious that, and really tragic that the information is out there that this person, like it was known that if Tupac were to attempt to fire this white person, his life would be in danger. If this was common knowledge among whoever it was, and then for it to actually happen, and then no one to be suspect or trying to share this information to as many people as possible is really interesting and suspicious. I definitely suspect the victim, Shug Knight, has some associations with some very powerful white people, but I may be incorrect. And also, when I heard the part, his eyes looked like they would never go dead or whatever. I was also confused at what that might meant. And I do suspect ghetto champion is racist code talk for nigger champion or whatever ending of that word that wants to be used. But I'll be my line. Thank you for letting me share and for the show.
Ghetto champion, for sure. Much obliged, sir. We will pause it there. Folks have additional comments, questions, just write them down, and then we'll go ahead and resume with the text. So we are in Chapter 5, Randall Sullivan, suspected man. Like, after this week's performance alone, it is really hard to say suspect, because, I mean, that is so galling. Our caller just said, no COINTELPRO. That's all you have to say about Geronimo Pratt, like, galling. But just for no name calling, suspected white supremacist, ran at least at minimum, really poor journalist, but I don't think that's what it is. Deliberate omission, once again, we talked about that last book. Randall Sullivan's Labyrinth, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment 2.
Shug Knight had spent much of the past year establishing himself as a presence in Las Vegas. The most visible indication of how Shug hoped to be viewed in Sin City was the house he purchased on Monte Rosa Avenue in the Paradise Valley Township, home to both the toniest estates and most influential citizens in the Las Vegas Valley. Shug's new house was right across the street from Wayne Newton's Shenandoah Ranch, and just two doors down from the home of fighter Mike Tyson, who had persuaded Knight to buy the place. Built of red brick, the house was a sprawling 5,215 feet set on 1.33 acres, with a backyard that bordered a golf course. Shug first had seen it in the Martin Scorsese film Casino, where it served as the home of the organized crime character played by Robert De Niro, Frank Lefty Rosenthal. Shug wore a 7-carat diamond in his ear when he made the deal to buy the place, then proceeded to redecorate in a style not seen previously even in garish Las Vegas, painting the bottom of his swimming pool blood red, then covering the interior of his home with same color carpet. Much of the furniture was red, too, as was the Rolls-Royce Corniche that Shug drove around town. Even before he purchased his house in Paradise Valley, Shug had endeavored to form associations with those connected to the organized crime families of New York and Chicago. Among the first Las Vegas attorneys he hired was John Spilotro, whose father, Tony the Ant Spilotro, had been headman for the Chicago mob during most of the 1970s, before being brutally beaten, then buried alive in an Indiana cornfield. Shug would step up a class when he retained the services of the notorious Oscar Goodman, an attorney who billed himself as mouthpiece for the mob, and represented most of the important mafiosi charged with crimes in Nevada, as well as Goodman's partner, the former U.S. attorney, David Chesoff. To open his new nightclub just off the strip, Shug had relied upon the only two Caucasians who were significant figures at Death Row Records. The first, of course, was David Kenner, whose connections to the Genovese family had long fascinated Suge. Perhaps even more helpful, though, was the accountant Suge had hired as Death Row's new business manager, Steve Cantrock. It was Cantrock who introduced Suge to Robert Amira, the Las Vegas businessman who several years earlier had been indicted along with Joseph Colombo Jr. and Alphonse the Whale Marola in a scheme to defraud the Dunes Hotel with an airline ticket scam. The case against Amira had been dismissed, in inimitable Las Vegas fashion, when the judge claimed he had seen the prosecutor and the jury foreman communicating improperly. With Amira's assistance, Suge was able to take possession of a club that had been known as Botany's back during his days at UNLV, when the patrons were mostly wealthy white people. Botany's previous owner had been convicted a few years earlier for helping the Chicago mob skim money from the Stardust Hotel, however, and the nightclub had languished ever since. Suge reopened the venue as the 662 Club and catered to a predominantly black clientele. The name 662 had multiple meanings. On a phone pad, those numbers spelled out MOB for Member of the Bloods. Tupac Shakur liked to say the letters stood for Money Over Bitches. The numbers 662 also appeared in the California Penal Code, however, where they were used to refer to death row inmates. Tupac's first performance after his release from the New York State prison system had been at the 662 Club in November of 1995. The club was packed to nearly twice its capacity that evening, and a crowd that included the entourages of athletes Mike Tyson and Deion Sanders got completely out of hand. The Las Vegas police were not happy about being forced to deal with this many drunk and dangerously violent characters and threatened to close the place down. The scene was only slightly less rowdy when Suge brought Tupac and Snoop Dogg back to Las Vegas with him for the Mike Tyson-Frank Bruno fight in the spring of 1996, and again when Suge and his Death Row entourage opened the club after Tyson's fight with Peter McNeely that August. Suge did post himself at the door of the club that night and personally tossed several troublemakers out into the parking lot, but the cops were furious anyway about the trouble the 662 Club was causing them and followed through on their promise to close the place. Knight was able to open the club for the evening of the Tyson-Seldon fight on September 7th, only by arranging to have his after-party sponsored by Las Vegas PD officer Patrick Barry, a retired professional boxer who was ostensibly using the event to raise money for Barry's boxing gym. A big sign on the club's marquee advertised the event as Barry's Boxing Benefit, while smaller letters identified the organizer as SKP, Suge Knight Productions. A line started forming outside the club at 5:30 that afternoon, hours before the fight's scheduled start, and hundreds of people were trying to buy $75 tickets for the 662 Club's party. Tupac Shakur was staying with Kidada Jones at the Luxor Hotel in one of the rooms Suge had booked for the weekend. Although his backup singers, the Outlaw Immortals, served as both an entourage and a security detail, Tupac's two main bodyguards were a pair of black ex-police officers, Kevin Hackey and Frank Alexander. Hackey wasn't in Las Vegas, however, having fallen out with Death Row's head of security, Reggie Wright Jr., over $10,000 he had been paid to work on the set of Tupac's most recent film, Gang Related. That money should have been paid to Right Way Protective Services, insisted Wright, who retaliated by firing the bodyguard. Frank Alexander was alone when he arrived for a meeting with Suge's Las Vegas attorneys, who explained that neither Alexander nor any of Tupac's other security personnel could carry firearms because Death Row had failed to secure the proper clearances from the police. While Alexander fretted about Tupac's vulnerability, the rapper himself was losing big at a blackjack table in the Luxor. The other members of the Death Row contingent noticed right off that Tupac wasn't wearing the medallion of the hooded figure in an electric chair that had been around his neck since Suge presented him with it months earlier. The new figure on Tupac's gold chain was a $30,000 diamond-studded replication of the emblem he had chosen for his own company, Euphanasia, a black angel of death, on its knees, head tilted down, backed by enormous wings and a golden halo. Tupac finally broke his losing streak and was ahead of the game when he left the casino and made his way across a footbridge to the MGM Grand, where the Tyson-Bruno fight would take place. Since his release from prison following a rape conviction, Tyson had become a heroic figure for many gangbangers who believed him persecuted and an honorary member of the Death Row family. Suge attended every one of his fights, and so did Tupac. Included with Knight and Shakur in the crowd that evening would be the Reverend Jesse Jackson, basketball stars Charles Barkley and Magic Johnson, as well as the hip-hop acts Run-DMC and Too Short. At the entrance to the big room where the MGM Grand staged its fights, Tupac was forced to stop and wait for Suge, who had the tickets. It had become commonplace in recent months for Suge to keep even his biggest stars waiting 2, 3, 4, even 5 hours so that he could make an entrance that established his dominance over them. As he watched other celebrities slip inside and take their seats, Tupac was surrounded by fans who pressed forward, ducking under the arms of security guards to take his photograph or demand an autograph. Finally, he lost his temper. "Fuck this shit," he told Alexander. "Every time we go somewhere, he always has to be fucking late. I didn't want to come to Vegas. No fucking way. We're gonna miss the fucking fight." Just as Shakur began to threaten to find his own tickets, Knight showed up. Tupac immediately wiped the angry expression from his face, recalled Alexander, who understood that the rapper still hoped for a more amicable parting with Suge than Dre had managed. Suge and Tupac sat together, but weren't in their seats long. The fight was over in less than 2 minutes, as Tyson came out of his corner throwing punches at a furious rate, and Seldon dropped to the canvas for good 109 seconds into the first round. While many at courtside were disappointed and a few even shouted that the fight had been fixed, Tupac was thrilled by what he'd witnessed. He danced around with a wild look in his eyes, pumping his arms and throwing punches at the air as he shouted, 50 blows! 50 blows! I counted them! Tupac led the Death Row group backstage to mingle with Tyson, but after only a couple of minutes, Suge announced that they had to leave. A startled Tupac complained that it would be the first time he had not congratulated Mike personally after a fight, but Big Suge grabbed the little rapper's arm and led him toward the exit. As they approached the auditorium's main entrance, Suge threw his arm around Tupac's shoulders, embracing him like the little brother that he often called his biggest star. Just as the two men passed through the doors, however, trailed by Alexander and Suge's entourage of Mob Piru homeboys, a blood named Trayvon Trey Lane approached Tupac and whispered something in his ear. Alexander could see trouble coming, especially after he watched Tupac turn his head to stare at a young black man who stood on the other side of the hallway, like he was anticipating the arrival of someone, as the bodyguard would put it later. The young man who stood alone was Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, a Southside Crip, who, along with 7 or 8 of his homies, had jumped him, Trey said, outside a Foot Locker store in the Lakewood Mall. Anderson and the other Crips had snatched the Death Row medallion off the chain on his neck as they pummeled him, Trey said. Anxious to impress Suge and the other Bloods with his continuing loyalty, Tupac immediately charged across the hallway toward Anderson, trailed by Knight and his entourage. "You from the South?" Tupac asked, but before Baby Lane could answer, Tupac had thrown a punch at him. The Crip went to the ground immediately, recalled Alexander, who found it difficult to believe the skinny rapper could hit that hard. And Baby Lane offered almost no resistance, Alexander said, as Suge and the other Bloods surrounded him, punching, kicking, and stomping. When Tupac's euthanasia medallion tore loose and fell to the ground, the rapper stooped to pick it up. Alexander, a bodybuilder who once had finished second in the Mr. World Championship, seized the opportunity to pull Tupac away and half-drag, half-carry him toward the nearest exit. Suge and the others were still on Anderson, kicking him while he was down, recalled Alexander, until the hotel's security force arrived on the scene. Suge shouted, "Let's go," and the others immediately scattered in different directions. Alexander led Tupac outside without waiting around to watch what would happen next, but they were at once spotted by a huge crowd of groupies and hangers-on who chased them back to the Luxor. Kidada, whom Alexander considered a surly, snobbish brat, was waiting in their room at the Luxor, where Tupac regaled her with a description of the beating. She was giggling in excitement, recalled Alexander. The girl seemed to love this stuff, though she never got any closer than hearing about it from her boyfriend. Tupac didn't invite her to the party at the 662 Club either, largely ignoring the young woman as he changed from a tan silk shirt and blue jeans into a black and white basketball tank top and teal-colored sweatpants, then led Alexander back downstairs. As they stepped outside the main entrance to the Luxor, Suge and the rest of the Death Row entourage were loading into a caravan of vehicles for the drive to the 662 Club. "They would go to his house first," announced Suge, who intended to delay their arrival so the group could make a grand entrance. Tupac wanted to drive his Hummer with Alexander in the passenger seat and two buddies from the Outlaws in back, but Suge told him that they had private business to discuss and persuaded the rapper to ride with him in the big new BMW sedan he had purchased 1 week earlier. Tupac told Alexander to drive his friend Yafu Fula and another member of the Outlaws to Suge's place in Kidada's Lexus. The group stayed only briefly at Knight's house, where everyone took a look at the new Death Row emblem painted on the bottom of the pool. The caravan that headed toward the strip about 15 minutes later was composed entirely of luxury vehicles. Mercedes, BMWs, Cadillacs, Lexuses. Suge's homies cranked up the Pioneer sound system in the caddy they drove, so loud that the ground was trembling, recalled Alexander, who followed right behind Suge's black BMW. Knight and Shakur were listening to Tupac's newest album, Machiavelli, at an obliterating volume until a police officer riding a bicycle waved them over and forced Suge to turn the sound down. When the cop let them go, Suge continued toward the strip. Alexander hoped that Suge would turn right on Tropicana so that they could enter the club from the rear, but instead, the BMW blew through a light and turned on Flamingo Road, where Tupac's approach to the club became a public spectacle. Cars filled with groupies whose breasts spilled out of low-cut dresses pulled up alongside to show Tupac their assets and angle for inclusion in his entourage. By the time the caravan approached the Maxim Hotel, dozens of cars filled mostly with young women had joined it, and the unarmed Alexander was becoming increasingly nervous. Scores of people on the street and sidewalk angled for a glimpse of Tupac when Suge stopped for a red light at Corval Lane, right behind the black Cadillac his homeboy K-Dove drove. A Chrysler sedan immediately pulled up on the BMW's left, filled with four young women who smiled to catch Tupac's attention. Moments later, a white Cadillac rolled to a stop slightly in front and to the right of the BMW. Four young black men were inside, witnesses said, two in front and two in back. But only one riding in the rear extended a .40 caliber Glock through the open left rear window and used it to spray the BMW's passenger side with between 10 and 15 bullets. According to Frank Alexander, the shooter had been sitting on the right side of the Cadillac and had reached across the passenger on his left to fire the shots. A black person wearing a skull cap, a beanie cap, was the best description of the killer Alexander could give. At least 100 witnesses watched as Tupac tried to climb into the back seat of the BMW and was hit 4 times in the process. 2 bullets tore open the Thug Life tattoo on his torso, while 2 others wounded him in the hand and leg. The Cadillac peeled away and made a right turn on Corval, heading away from the strip. Instead of calling 911 on his flip phone, Suge made a U-turn against the oncoming traffic as vehicles scattered to avoid a collision. The rest of the Death Row caravan did the same, jumping medians as they headed toward the strip. 2 bicycle cops who had heard the shots gave chase and were able to catch the BMW only because 2 of the car's tires had been shot out. The shooting scene itself was abandoned as witnesses scattered and the white Cadillac sped away. When Suge stopped the BMW, the 2 bicycle cops approached with guns drawn and ordered him out of the car. Suge stepped outside with one side of his head dripping in blood and told the officers he had been shot in the head. They made him get down on his knees anyway, as ambulances and cars sped to the scene, which within moments had become a maelstrom of flashing lights and shrieking sirens. Many in the huge crowd rushed forward and tried to retrieve mementos from the BMW, tearing off side-view mirrors, wire-rimmed hubcaps, and door handles. The cops screamed at them to get back and threatened to arrest everyone in sight. By the time paramedics delivered Tupac to Las Vegas' University Medical Center, he had lost a lot of blood. A team of surgeons removed his shattered left lung that night, then operated again the next morning. Doctors gave him a 50-50 chance of survival, then when Tupac regained consciousness, said the odds might be better than that. Outside the hospital, the Outlaw Immortals held prayer vigils with the rapper's fans, who drove media photographers away whenever they tried to snap pictures. In the hospital lobby, a teenage girl chanted lyrics from Tupac's All Eyes on Me album, 5 shots and they still couldn't kill me. Outside Tupac's room, Jesse Jackson and Minister Tony Muhammad, head of the Nation of Islam's L.A. chapter, comforted the rapper's family. Jackson was said to be a close friend of Afeni Shakur's, but didn't sound much like it when he delivered a sermon the next day at a black church in Las Vegas. Before you condemn Tupac for calling women bitches and hoes in his music, you need to understand and know about the background of this man, Jackson told both parishioners and the media in attendance. He was raised by a mama who was on crack. He didn't have a real mama. Don't condemn him for talking about his mama and for talking about women. The man the Las Vegas police were looking for was Suge Knight, who had left town despite being asked not to. When Suge was spotted at Death Row's offices in Beverly Hills on September 9th, David Kenner promised the Vegas police that Mr. Knight would appear for questioning the next day, but Suge never showed. He did arrive at the Las Vegas PD's homicide headquarters on the evening of the 11th, however, accompanied by Kenner, David Chesoff, and a third attorney. It was the only interview the Las Vegas police would ever conduct with Suge, and afterward the disgruntled detectives let reporters know that Knight had not been helpful in solving the case. Less than 48 hours later, at 4:04 p.m. on Friday the 13th, 25-year-old Tupac Shakur was pronounced dead from respiratory failure and cardiopulmonary arrest. Suge arrived at the hospital in a black Lexus moments after the announcement was made. When he stepped out of the car, the crowd went quiet. Reporters noted that the supposed gunshot wound on his head was barely visible. Upstairs, Suge spoke briefly with Tupac's family, then walked out the front entrance with a cigar between his teeth, not 10 minutes after his arrival. Suge would discover his own vulnerability only 4 days later when the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office announced that it was removing Larry Longo as the prosecutor on the case involving Suge's assault of the Stanley Brothers at the Solar Records Studios back in 1992. Word that Longo's daughter had signed a recording contract with Death Row was leaked to the media, and almost every statement that issued from the Longo family during the next few days would be met with derision. The most quoted comment was one Longo had made a month after Suge cut his deal for a suspended sentence. "I have never seen a guy transform as much as this guy has since he was first booked," the prosecutor had told reporters. "It's remarkable." More remarkable to most of the media was the insistence of Longo's son, Frank, that he and David Kenner had independently negotiated the deal that made his 18-year-old sister, Gina, the first and only white performer signed by Death Row Records. Gina Longo defended herself by saying, "I'm no Milli Vanilli. The reason I'm on Death Row has nothing to do with my dad." Suge, meanwhile, managed to keep a straight face when he said that Gina had the voice of Billie Holiday, only in a white girl's body. If anyone out there believed that, he was hard to find, especially in the district attorney's office. When Longo reported to work on the morning of October 25th, his superiors told him to go home. Reporters who now knew that Suge Knight was living in the Longo's Malibu colony home peppered the DA's office with phone calls and questions. Lawrence Longo would be fired from his job before the end of the year. The even worse news for Suge was that the attack on Orlando Anderson at the MGM Grand had been captured on videotape, and the DA's office had decided to argue that Knight's participation in the beating was a violation of his probation. At almost the same moment, the judge who had agreed to Suge's rather unusual grant of probation, John Outerkirk, was replaced by the much tougher Stephen Schuliger. Suge already had been sent to L.A. County Jail after failing a court-ordered drug test 3 days earlier. A hearing on a motion by the district attorney's office to revoke his probation was scheduled for February of 1997. Suge's image only darkened during the next few weeks. On November 6, 1996, Knight was the subject of a report by ABC's Primetime Live that began, "Some say he's the most dangerous man in music." Though the ABC report later would be discredited because of its reliance upon the exaggerated claims of Vanilla Ice, plenty of damage was done in the short term, as investigations of Suge by both news organizations and law enforcement agencies seemed to crop up on an almost weekly basis. The most compelling media reports involved claims that startup money for Death Row Records had been supplied not only by Michael Harris, but also by another notorious drug kingpin, Ricardo Crockett. Suge had been stopped by police in Beverly Hills with a gun in his glove compartment that had been purchased illegally by an associate of Crockett's. Though convicted of transporting the gun across state lines, Suge won a grant of probation in federal court. At the same time, however, it was reported that the U.S. Justice Department had organized a multi-agency task force to investigate claims that Shug and Death Row were trafficking in both guns and drugs. The really bad news was that Steve Cantrock had become a federal witness. Cantrock worked for the conservative New York-based firm Coopers & Lybrand, but was known as one of the accounting trade's most colorful figures, a hippie-turned-hustler who enjoyed socializing with clients like the members of hard rock bands Slaughter and White Zombie. He and Knight had seemed to hit it off at first, but they began to bicker during the summer of 1996 over Shug's suspicion that Cantrock was skimming money. And when American Express filed a lawsuit claiming that Shug Knight, David Kenner, and Kenner's wife had run up more than $1.5 million in unpaid bills, Shug and Kenner said that the expenses had been incurred by their rogue accountant, Steve Cantrock. Things came to a head at a meeting in the backyard of a San Fernando Valley home owned by singer Michele. From county jail, Shug told reporters the meeting was Cantrock's idea and described what happened this way. "After I caught him stealing millions of dollars and confronted him, he started crying. I said, 'Okay, Steve, don't get so bent out of shape.'" Cantrock's account was considerably different. Shug showed up for the meeting accompanied by not only David Kenner, but also several of his blood henchmen, Cantrock said. Then began the meeting by stating, "All right, cut the bullshit, Steve. How much did you steal from me?" Before he could respond, Cantrock said Shug doubled him over with a punch to the solar plexus. As he sank to the ground sobbing, Cantrock said, he heard Shug tell someone that he wanted a confession. David Kenner produced a handwritten document moments later and passed it to Shug, who handed it to him, Cantrock said, and told him he better sign it. Convinced he would die if he didn't, Cantrock said he wrote his signature. The accountant promptly disappeared. A security guard was posted in the lobby at the Los Angeles office of Coopers & Lybrand, where receptionists told callers that Cantrock was away on stress leave. Word swiftly spread that Cantrock and his family had fled the country, but by late December of 1996, the Los Angeles Times was reporting that Cantrock had become a federal witness and would supply the U.S. Justice Department with reams of documents detailing Death Row's financial dealings over the last 3 years. Even as Shug hired Milton Grimes to represent him in the criminal racketeering investigation being conducted by the feds, he was forced to defend himself against a civil racketeering lawsuit filed by Afeni Shakur that accused Knight, Kenner, and Death Row of a pattern of fraud and deception in their dealings with her late son. Shug answered by claiming that, in fact, the Shakur estate owed him millions for monies advanced to Tupac and his family. Afeni asked reporters how it was possible that Tupac's albums could generate more than $60 million in revenues for Death Row, while the artist himself received less than $1 million in royalties. After American Express filed its lawsuit against Death Row, creditors came out of the woodwork. One lawsuit asked for $75 million and sought to have the record company put into receivership. Shug's mentor, Dick Griffey, joined forces with the DOC, meanwhile, to file a $125 million breach of promise lawsuit against Death Row. More ominous for Shug was the claim by Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Bill Hodgman that Shug should be forced to serve his 9-year prison sentence for the assault on the Stanley brothers. The MGM Grand's videotape of the Orlando Anderson beating was the strongest evidence against Shug, Hodgman told the court. At Knight's bail hearing, David Kenner argued that the tape showed Shug had not been a part of the assault, and in fact had tried to prevent others from attacking Anderson. When Judge Chuliger looked at the tape, he agreed with Hodgman. "It looks like he's trying to get a last lick in, that's what it looks like to me." Ruling on Kenner's request for bail, Chuliger said, "He's had every reason to believe things would work out. No one said enough's enough, that's it. This judge would." Bail was denied. While Shug sat in his cell at county jail, word spread on the street that Knight had bought out the jail commissary in order to distribute gifts to the other Bloods and buy protection. Death Row was still a force in the music business, but for how long, no one knew. The label would put out 2 of the 3 biggest-selling rap albums of 1996 while Shug awaited his court hearing. First came Tupac's posthumous Machiavelli, followed shortly by Snoop Dogg's The Dogfather. Unfortunately for Shug, however, Snoop was the only real star still signed to Death Row, and he wanted to leave the label in order to save his life. Snoop presently owns and oftentimes travels in an armored van equipped with gun ports. Sharitha Knight would claim in a lawsuit that accused Snoop of failing to pay agents' commissions of $1.6 million during the time her Death Row subsidiary Nightlife served as his manager. Death threats have been reported against the defendant. The defendant's life appears in jeopardy. In other words, an LA Weekly writer observed, Sharitha Knight wants her money before Snoop gets shot. Snoop, meanwhile, was already making plans for a life after Death Row. And during the next few months, he would record cameos with nearly a dozen singers and rappers from other labels. He also began talking about a reunion project with Dr. Dre. Snoop can't talk on it. Nobody can, really. But everybody's trying to get away from Death Row. His father, Vernal Vernado, would advise another Los Angeles reporter. When Suge showed up in court for his hearing in February of 1997, he was not wearing one of his famous red suits, but rather the blue jumpsuit of a Los Angeles County Jail inmate. His most important witness also wore blue, Southside Crip Orlando Anderson. Anderson, who had cursed Suge bitterly after the beating, now said that Knight played the peacemaker when Tupac Shakur and seven others attacked him at the MGM Grand. "I seen him pulling people off me," said Anderson, who described Suge as the only one yelling, "Stop this stuff!" A pair of Compton police officers, however, told the court that Anderson's story had been quite different when they interviewed him in October of 1996. He basically said he had been jumped by some Bloods. Also Suge and Tupac, one of them explained. A Las Vegas police detective said Anderson had told him that Tupac and Suge beat him up pretty good. And the MGM Grand security manager told Judge Chuliger that she had seen Suge kick Anderson three times. Kenner's answer was a man who said he choreographed fight scenes for action movies and was good friends with Steven Seagal. He had watched the videotape 100 times, said the man, who testified that a frame-by-frame breakdown had convinced him Suge's hands were in a defensive posture. He's trying to stop the activity from going any further. Judge Chuliger clearly wasn't buying it and ruled that Suge was an active participant in the attack on Orlando Anderson. Before the judge could issue a final ruling, however, David Kenner produced a psychiatrist who was being paid $250 an hour to tell the court that he strongly disagreed with a probation report that claimed Mr. Knight was criminally oriented. Mr. Knight was a socially active and concerned citizen of the black community who displayed neither a propensity for violence nor what he would describe as antisocial behavior, the doctor said. He's not a dangerous person. Kenner also called witnesses who testified that Suge was an advocate of black citizens who had distributed Thanksgiving turkeys and Christmas toys to the poor people of Compton while an inmate at county jail. Suge was a compassionate man, declared Danny J. Blakewell of the Brotherhood Crusade. Another witness noted the presence in court of C. Dolores Tucker, who believed that Suge could use his prominence to steer young black men away from gangs. This was a distinctly ironic moment, given that Suge had almost single-handedly destroyed Tucker's reputation, calling her, among other things, a hoax who claimed the title doctor on the basis of honorary degrees from obscure colleges. Tucker was presently the target of a Death Row lawsuit that accused her of having an economic motive for her public criticism of gangsta rap. Still, the woman sat nodding in court as one Raheem Jenkins told the court that if Dr. Tucker could forgive Suge Knight, then the judge, too, should embrace him. Suge himself took the stand to tell Judge Chuliger, "I definitely don't want to do my life behind bars, but if it's more positive for the community by me being incarcerated, I'm willing to sacrifice myself." He thanked C. Dolores Tucker and said she had helped him come to a decision that he would never allow the word nigger to be used on another Death Row Records release. Bill Hodgman replied with a recitation of highlights from Suge's criminal history. A plea of guilty to battery with a deadly weapon in Las Vegas during 1987, pleas of guilty to separate charges of battery in Beverly Hills and Hollywood in 1990, and a plea of guilty to disturbing the peace in Van Nuys that same year. A conviction in 1991 when he gave a false name after being arrested in possession of a concealed weapon. Another conviction, this one for assault with a deadly weapon, in Las Vegas in 1992, plus 1995 convictions for conspiracy to illegally possess a firearm and for assault with a firearm. Judge Schuliger ordered that Shug should be detained by the California Department of Corrections for a 90-day diagnostic examination, then return to his courtroom in May to be sentenced to state prison. 2 weeks later, Biggie Smalls was shot dead in Los Angeles, and from the first day, investigators let it be known that they considered Shug Knight the prime suspect.
All righty. That's what we'll end that for this week. So next week we'll pick up part three as we continue with Labyrinth. That's happened a few times. I just keep saying that most of the time I thought investigators like, hey, we don't have a suspect. We will, you know, investigate and see where the clues go. Like, how is it? And immediately this guy did it and this guy's in greater confinement. Like, how is that? Not David Kenner? Context of white supremacy. Gus T, the number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll finish up investor emailed in. Let's see. From chapter 5, he writes, number one, Tupac's 1996, All Eyes on Me. Oh, read that one. Number two, Tupac wasn't wearing the medallion of the hooded figure in an electric chair. Tupac's gold chain, chosen for his own company, Euthanasia, a black angel of death on its knees, head tilted down, backed by enormous wings and a golden halo. I went back to Dr. Curry's book, The Man Knot, since he talked about a lot about black males and death and thought this passage might be relevant. The black male is defined by this distance to man, his nature being replaced with that of the brute and savage. He is made into horror. He is literally met with death. The effect of disposability and fungibility, because in the minds of others who sees him, he represents death. He is the greatest fear in need of extermination. That is one to think on. We read Dr. Curry's The Man Knot in the book club 2018. 3 years? Yikes. Number three, U.S. Justice Department has organized a multi-agency task force to investigate claims that Suge Knight and Death Row were trafficking in both guns and drugs. Maybe another COINTELPRO type effort. Absolutely. And again, David Kenner and all this is allowed to go on. Very suspicious. White people could be involved in it all. I'm so glad we read about Julius Butler before we got to this text. Let's see. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Anybody, if you have thoughts, questions that you want to contribute, Ghetto Champion, if you think you know what that is, you can share that as well. Let's see. Retired firefighter, Rob in California, Henry in Chicago, any other folks, if you have commentary to share. Line should be open. Proceed. Folks might be taking time. Well, we don't have a whole lot of time, so can't take too much, but I'll share a few of my notes while folks are thinking. Maybe nothing popped up from the second reading, chapter 5, where we were. Let's see. Things that I took, notes that I took. Let's see. The portion where he says, Suge Knight, he's opening this club in Vegas. He says, to open his new nightclub just off the strip, Suge had relied upon the only two Caucasians who were significant figures at Death Row Records. Now, that's even important because there are enforcement officers who said, hey, there were many police officers, LAPD, who worked for Death Row. Some of them were white. They weren't all black officers who worked for Death Row Records. So if there are white police officers who also work here, I'd say that's significant as well. But either way, continuing. The first, of course, was David Kenner, whose connections to the Genovese family had long fascinated Suge Knight. Perhaps even more helpful, though, was the accountant Suge had hired as Death Row's new business manager, Steve Cantrock. It was Cantrock who introduced Suge to Robert Amira, the Las Vegas businessman, who several years earlier had been indicted along with Joseph Colombo Jr. and Alphonse the Whale Marola in a scheme to defraud the Dunes Hotel with an airline ticket scam. These are the gangsters, these white folks. Again, watch The Godfather. Watch it all the way through. See the sequel. Individuals classified as white. These are the gangsters. They didn't say Suge Knight went to get Al Sharpton to get things done. He wants to open this club up in Vegas. Let me go find some white people. Where's the Dave Kenner at? Yes, that's how I need my white friends. Maybe need two of them to get some things done. Let's see. 662. And again, these the significance of the numbers. They even say that 662 in the California Penal Code is a death penalty. Like, that's what I want to be associated with and thought of. So we go back to Mike Tyson and Deion Sanders. Entourages. So they, when they had parties with Mike Tyson and Deion Sanders, the entourages got out of hand. The Las Vegas police were not happy about being forced to deal with this many drunk and dangerous, violent characters and threatened to close the place down. Now, on the one hand, I can grasp, but on the other hand, I said, now, wait a minute. I just said The Godfather Part 2. I saw Godfather, Michael Corleone and all that, Mo Green. I saw that. Like, you are not going to tell me that, hey, we are tired of having to be forced to deal with all these dangerous, violent criminals. Like, in Las Vegas, maybe someplace else, but I mean in Las Vegas? Are you kidding me? They got flyers for strippers and prostitution falling from the heavens. Gangsters here and there. Get out. Come on. They got slot machines in the grocery store in Las Vegas. They never tell me we just want upstanding citizens. We're tired of having all these violent criminal figures around here at Suge Knight's club. Why can't we have some respectable folks? Let's see. Deep fried Twinkies on top of that. Let's see. Okay, since his release from prison following a rape conviction, talking about Tupac. Oh, excuse me, talking about Mike Tyson. Tyson had become a heroic figure for many ghetto gangbangers and an honorary member of the Death Row family. Now, this is another one. I almost thought he was going to say ghetto champion. I was like, whoa, we got two ghetto champions. But we got a ghetto champion and a heroic figure for ghetto gangbangers. You can't just be for gangbangers, for ghetto gangbangers. Randall Sullivan. Let's see. Next it says, Tupac was thrilled by what he'd witnessed, the Tyson fight. He danced around with a wild look in his eyes. So we got these descriptions of black people in their eyes. Remember last book, Jack Olson? He was talking about when Jack, the Reverend, McCohen, I believe was his name. McCloskey, Jim McCloskey. He was going to visit the different black neighborhoods. And I guess it was a Blood Crip thing. He had on red or blue or the wrong color. He said, oh my God, their eyes got as big as pancakes. I've never seen a person with eyes the size of pancakes. I don't know the wild-eyed look. Remember that you could be lynched. Many a black person was lynched for reckless eyeballing. And wild eyeballs, whatever that means. Let's see. Anything else? We talked about the night of the shooting with Mr. Patash back in the day. Even this sort of thing, like normal black people, sometimes if there is a vehicle accident and you leave the scene of the crime, like, you can be arrested. They have a shooting, turns out to be a fatal shooting. Suge Knight leaves. They've told him not to. He leaves anyway. Like, whoa. Why isn't that obstruction of justice? Like, they could make things difficult for you. Nah, I got my way. They say he leaves town. Suge Knight, he says, when Suge was spotted at Death Row's offices in Beverly Hills on September 9, David Kenner promised the Vegas police that Mr. Knight would appear for questioning the next day, but Suge never showed. He did arrive at the Las Vegas Police Homicide Headquarters on the evening of the 11th. However, accompanied by Kenner, David Chesoff, and a third attorney, probably someone white, I guess. It was the only interview the Las Vegas police would ever conduct with Suge, and afterward, the disgruntled detectives let reporters know that Knight had not been helpful in solving the case. He had to, his white man, didn't have to be. I don't have to do nothing. In fact, I got a whole team of white people, including my white friend David Kenner, so, nah, I have to answer your questions or do anything else. Let's see, anything else?
This service is provided in high definition by free access code accepted. There are 11 participants in the conference. Q&A session has started. The recording has started.
Got muted or dropped. Excuse me. Got dropped completely. Sorry. Back. Last thing, and then we'll see with other folks if they had anything they wanted to share from the second audio. I'm no Millie Vanilli. When Longo's daughter was talking about how she got this deal on Death Row, the only white performer, it's like, I just had a thought. Were they thinking she was lip syncing or what? Metaphors, I say that all the time. Suge's image only darkened during the next few weeks. Say that all the time. All these metaphors, a dark cloud, and everything bad and vile and evil is associated with black people. Anything else? So, this beating where David Kenner is present and Suge Knight is beating up Cantrock, where did he get this from? This is another one. Like, did Cantrock speak with him? Is this from an interview where he says, yeah, Suge Knight came and he had David Kenner with him and they're like, you know, you stole from me and how much did you take from me and all that? I don't know if Cantrock is a white person or not, but if he is a white person and this happened, like, again, wow, who is this Suge Knight fella? What friends does white friends does he get? David Kenner and the like? Is this what you're allowed to do? You can go around and terrorize even other white people sometimes, right? Like, wow, that is amazing. White friends. Bill Hodgman, we heard his name again. He was in the O.J. Simpson trial. One of the prosecutors, he had a heart attack, so I guess he recovered. White man with medical insurance and what have you, says more ominous for Suge was the claim by Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Bill Hodgman that Suge should be forced to serve his 9-year prison sentence for the assault on the Stanley brothers because of this violation at the Tyson fight, the beating and what have you. And then the last one, I guess I'll get the last two. Second, from O.J. Simpson, Danny J. Blackwell, he was one of the ones who was out protesting and talking about the case. I think he got involved towards the end when the Mark Furman tapes were going to be debated about whether they should be released. And I think he got involved in saying that they needed to be released so that black people could know the full extent of what this fella said, Mark Furman. And black community, one of the worst terms ever. Mr. Knight was socially active. Mr. Knight was socially active and concerned citizen of the black community who displayed neither a propensity for violence nor what he would describe as antisocial behavior. Yeah. Oh, this is from the David Kenner produced psychiatrist at $250 an hour. That Suge Knight is a great part of the black community. That right there would be enough for me. You got a white attorney, probably with a white psychiatrist up here talking about Suge Knight as a great part of the black community. Like, all of you all are in contempt. You know it's no such thing as a black community. Get out of here. Let's see. Mo in Dallas, did you have commentary that you wanted to make sure you shared before we get ready to wrap things up?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Greetings, guys. Greetings, listeners and callers. Can I be heard clearly?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. I'll be brief. I know it is late in the program. from the first audio segment, Elmer Pratt, Tupac's godfather, convicted of murdering a school teacher. Like, for I know a comment was made the last segment, but that was just a tacky way to acknowledge Elmer Geronimo Pratt, especially with the understanding that this book was written after the death of Tupac. And I got cut out of the program. I assume Elmer Pratt was free at the time this book was written. I just assumed. So I could be in error. I don't know. I don't know when it was written at all. So I'm sorry about that. But also a quote where Tupac had it was a quote. I'm using the word quote in quotation. I finally felt like an artist. I was fornicating with white women or messing with white girls is what he said. What was said. And I don't like the it was just I guess tacky the way that was written, as if that's the way that conversation was going. I'm not certain if these two quotes went together, like if he said them together or if he just said them like separately, like, you know, what kind of women you like, and then do you feel like an artist? Like those could be two different questions that, if not preference, could be squeezed together or put together and make it imply that I'm an artist because I'm sleeping with white women. I'm not sure if they were given the proper context. There are plenty of black males that sleep with white women who do not identify themselves as artists. That's the issue I have with that. Like, so you get a white woman and you're an artist? Doesn't make sense. I did note how, after the shooting in the book, the officers still made Suge Knight get down on his knees, bleeding from the side of his head. You know, that was the man not, you know. Obviously a victim of a shooting, a shot up car, but still you get down. I think that's all I have on my line.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. The man not indeed. And I mean, talk about all of that, the delectable Negro. Tupac is literally dying. They're coming and snatching the hubcaps and the door handles, he said, so that I snatch this off the car. Like, you're not evidence, maybe? Crime scene contamination. You got all these odd fingerprints now on the vehicle from people who just wanted a momentum. That's like a lynching scene, right? I just wanted to come and grab some of the rope or whatever. We got the dead Negro. Disgraceful.
Definitely.
Delectable Negro.
Thank you.
Retired firefighter, I believe that was.
Yes, sir. I was just thinking from listening to the first and second parts, the two personalities. One was this minister. His first name was Calvin. I think that was the person who replaced Adam Clayton Powell from Abyssinia Baptist Church, that famous church in Harlem. They kind of like briefly talked about him. The lady, her first name was Dolores, also was attempting to pursue Miami's own Luther Campbell for years about his style of rap. Don't ask me what it would be called. yeah, she was known for that also. Through the second reading, I remember the occasion after the Tyson fight in Las Vegas, and they were just kind of like going crazy. Like I said, insanity is a word. I mean, I just don't see how somebody would have the want to live in that style. But I guess you can get used to just about anything if you've been doing it long enough. But to have to manage to be looking over your shoulder 24/7 and at the same time embark of a lifestyle of intimidation and bullying, I don't know. I guess some people are comfortable with that type of life. But nevertheless, that's what I think actually what was taking place. Maybe Mr. Knight was actually clandestinely supported by some elements of law enforcement. Well, not law enforcement, but actually race soldiers, powerful ones, our figure, based on what I'm hearing. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Certainly could be the case. In terms of what you were saying about, you know, this way of life where you got to go around and terrorize people and bully them, and then you got to constantly be kind of paranoid, or they're going to try and take out revenge, or somebody else going to try and do the same thing to me and show that they're tough, that type of thing. It seems that most of the folks that he's describing in the book came to the same conclusion, because it seems like everybody, almost all the main folks that we hear about this after a while, are like, hey, this is no life for me. Just having to go around and beat up people all the time, and other people want to beat us up, and talking about this and this whole lifestyle, like, I think he quoted Tupac Shakur saying, hey, I'm a businessman, we're business people, we're not animals, we are in business, the business of entertainment, music specifically, or I guess, yeah, entertainment, because he's making films and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's super important.
Until they decided to throw him in the garbage.
Hey.
Which is, in both cases, the ultimate end.
Pretty much. Yeah. Sometimes it's no retirement plan, like no leaving. This is the life. That's what they say in The Godfather. This is the life that you chose. That's one of the lessons sometimes. It's no getting out of it, so. Decision that you kind of have to make sometimes can be very difficult to extricate yourself from all of that incorrect behavior, which it seems he talked about a lot of that in this text as well. For Snoop Dogg, Tupac, lots of these folks, kind of difficult to get out of all this. So, yeah, think about that in terms of how you want to live and choices that we make in the system of white supremacy. And again, white people will do a lot of encouraging us to make these type of choices, particularly when it's going to be harming other black people, including yourself. But anything harming other black people, yes, do more of it. How can we promote that? So we talk all the time, minimizing conflict. This is the exact opposite of that. No, be in conflict, do a lot of name calling, exclusively other black people. We're in a system of white supremacy. They don't have one song. You know, we're just going to talk about Whitey. This is right after Rodney King and O.J. Simpson. We don't have a hit 'em up talking about Mark Furman. No. We get to him later. We're going to talk about Biggie Smalls, Sean Combs, and a whole lot of other black people. We'll get to Mark Furman later. Next album. On Death Row. We will be here next Thursday as we continue. City of a Lie. And that was the other thing. We can end this. I'm so glad retired firefighter asked about who is the narrator. Kevin Free. To me, looks like a black male. I could be wrong. Folks can look online. He's got his profile picture, website, all that good stuff. Now, I said City of Lies, 2018, the adaptation, film adaptation of this book. They have Forrest Whitaker as Randall Sullivan. To have Kevin Free, black male, narrating this book might be the same thing. I don't know how people would hear this book, because we've heard most of the niggers that we're going to hear in this book. We've heard them now. I don't know how we would be feeling about this book if it was a white man, Mark Furman sounding white man or whatever, narrating this book, nigga that, niggas this, nigga that, ghetto nigga, nigga champion. Like, I don't know. It would just be a very different experience, I think, for folks, whatever that means, sounding white. But, I have to think about that. Like I said, now I have to think about it for sure, because that's like two different ways of racial showcasing. You get a non-white person narrate this and tell me all this and leave out all this pertinent information, and then you do the film adaptation and you get Forrest Whitaker to be Randall Sullivan.
Gus, can I ask a question?
Mo in Dallas, yes.
I know you're ready to end. Okay, I know the program's almost over. There are a couple of things that I'm issues that I'm having with the book, or just that I'm wondering about, rather, like how some of the conversations are like, you know, playing out, and how he's like describing the situations. I'll give you an example. Like he says Jesse Jackson knew Tupac Shakur well, and then after he had passed, called his mother a crackhead. While he was dying, called his mother a crackhead. Or a drug addict in some capacity. Now that doesn't, you know, register well with me, because it's not footnoted. You know, if he could quote, you know, this day, this article says Jesse Jackson said this, or Tupac told Kadada Jones this, you know, bragging about the fight. From what I heard, she wasn't happy he had a fight. With that being said, is this book listed under fictional or non-fictional, just for my clarification? Like, or is it even classified as fictional or non-fictional?
I think this came up when we read Jeffrey Toobin, Run of His Life, because there were so many lies and error, or both, whatever you want to call it, lies, errors in the book at minimum. A lot of lies and then maybe some errors too, whatever. To say, hey, like, is this fiction? Is it nonfiction? Like, how do we even classify this text? The same thing came up. So let's see how we'll see how this is listed. I suspect it's probably nonfiction. That would be my guess. I could be wrong. Let's see how they list it here. True accounts. That's what I thought. True accounts. It's in the crime section, criminology, true crime, that word, true crime. I think that was with the O.J. Simpson, because that's in true crime, murder, all that same thing. It's like, wait a minute. How can this be in true crime if it's got a lot of lies and errors in it? You were saying?
I was thinking in a world that produced justice, I feel like the victims, like, well, first, I feel like the author was practicing racism and writing this book, and I feel like the victims that he was dishonest about would be able, or should be able, to pursue the author for some sort of slander charges, like, for some of the things. There are a couple of things I just know that aren't true, but yeah. I'm in my line. Thank you.
If I was Geronimo Pratt, I would be upset. Like, hey, man, like, they lied on me. Like, you're going to leave all that out? This book was published in 2002. Like, I have been out of prison for 5 years chilling. Like, you can't get a sentence in there about my 27 years in COINTELPRO and all that? Like, nothing? Come on. Come on. At minimum, like I said, it would be kind to just say this is a little bit lazy journalism by Randall Sullivan. Nah. That's not what I think it is. I think this is deliberate white supremacy racism in the narrative that we're giving. And that sort of deliberate racism, that's why you need Forrest Whitaker. That's what I'm saying. That's why you need Kevin Free to narrate this book. Maybe I'm wrong. We've not read the whole thing. we'll continue. We'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism. I am so appreciating reading all of these together. I was a little hesitant because there are other books I want to read. Woody Allen's biography, autobiography, like, oh my God, like, woo, the whites talking about Jeff Toobin and sexual assault and abusing of children, like, oh my Lord, I cannot wait, like Woody Allen's autobiography. But it has been so wonderful to read all three of these together and to really put things in context in the same time period and the same people. It's great. We should have done this before and taken, because there are so many books that could have been weaved together like this. I hope if people have listened to all three of these, like, I hope it's been a very informative experience. And if you haven't, man, you will get so much more out of all three of these books, I think, if you listen to them together. You'll learn tons about Johnny Cochran and Los Angeles in general. If you live in California, oh yeah, you should definitely, maybe, I don't want to say own, because Jeffrey Toobin masturbating him, I'm like, but maybe check them out. Listen, study. They would definitely be worth studying, these three events, these three books, if you are a California resident, Southern LA. That's it. We'll be here tomorrow. Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Record heat expected in Seattle. They said temperatures never before seen in this area. We have heat warnings in effect from now. I think it's either from tomorrow or now until Tuesday, where I don't think I've ever seen 100-degree heat here since I've been here. I don't even know if they've had triple-digit heat in Seattle specifically, like in recorded history of them keeping track of temperatures in this region. So, man, we will see if we can get through. Most of the residents here, like Gus, do not have AC in their houses and such. So we will just do our best to get through the next few days and hope things don't melt down. Pray for Gus if it's not too much trouble. If you have to go out and about, I guess stay hydrated and then be real mindful. There's lots of wild shootings and all that. Saw the building collapse in Miami today. Like, my goodness. Be alert to things that are happening around you. If it looks like someone is being loud and hostile, be thinking this person may be armed. I will be very careful and, in fact, look to get out of there. This person may have a whole entourage of armed individuals ready to do harm. If you didn't leave your residence, prepare to kill and or die. Exit promptly. I'll say it again just because it's needed. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy racism. I know summer is break, record heat. It is summertime. Grand, get outside. We've been locked down and all that. Get that vitamin D, get some exercise, get some fresh air. But man, brain computers functioning well because we're sober. In addition to our sobriety, we are really going to be buckled when we go out, driver or passenger. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone, just doing the small things to minimize contact with race soldiers as best we can. And we need all of our attention. Be mindful of what's happening around you. Folks being rowdy. Lot to be mindful about. Creator, help us remain patient with other victims of white supremacy. Help us to be patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Man, with all the nonsense and no footnotes, excellent point, Mo and Dallas Reid. It's hard to follow the book or to believe some of the claims because it's no footnotes. Absolutely vital claim charge that'll be present throughout the text. But man, the name calling, that is one that is for sure legit. No name calling. There is no example of calling another black person a whole bunch of names where that's going to solve any problems or help our situation at all. No name calling, no gossiping. That was a big part of this too. Gossiping, no name calling, no gossiping, minimizing conflict with other black people. Huge one, huge one. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.